full advantage of your precious farmland, I suggest you try new 10-20-10 Vertigro with your fall planting.
Yes, sir. Vertigro can increase your yield by 25%.
You like that? Wait till you hear this one. Let's do Olive V.
I don't think we better, buddy. It's for the bumpers.
Try Vertigro.
Hey, Olive V.
Buddy, I don't think we better.
Hey.
We'd like to do this one for the boppers. Those of you who bop.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Yours, Mine, and Theirs. I'm J-O-N-M-A-D-S-E-N. Find out why there is no H. Jonathan, 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 Jonathan. My name is John. No H. John, 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 John. Okay, who else we got?
I hate you, John.
Was that yours?
Okay. I'm Roy. R-O-Y-P-E-C-T. Find out what Roy's pect means to me. Roy, 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 Roy. Just a little bit.
Way to steal from me right on the spot.
Yeah.
And I'm Phil, and I have a relatively underwhelming intro. I once met Pete Best in the lobby of the Blackfriars Art Centre in Boston and Lincolnshire, and that makes me surely the fifth and sixth and seventh Beatles.
Did you really meet Pete Best?
Woo. I mean, meet him, yeah. I mean, I went up to him as a 16-year-old and said, can I have an autograph, please?
Wow.
And he gave me that, and that was that.
I didn't tell you this, I met Ringo in Barney's in New York.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't meet him. I saw him try on a jacket, and then I saw him put the jacket back, and then I bought that jacket.
Cool story, bro.
Yeah. So anyway, he was like 4 feet tall. It was weird. So, Okay, welcome again, Phil. This is your second time in a row with us, and it's always a pleasure to have you. Welcome, sort of as usual, Roy. You're always here, and I can't get rid of you, but that's fine. This is Yours, Mine, and Theirs, in which we watch three movies, and they're kind of in a weird category that we place together, we clump them together, and then we give awards to those three movies. So this time, the movies are actual historical musical events that happened, maybe, but they're movies, so probably only like 10% of what we saw is true. Yeah, there's no way to know, because we weren't there. But we watched the Buddy Holly story, and we watched Backbeat. It's about the Beatles, sorta. And we watched the movie Respect about Aretha Franklin. So that's
and the Columbo episode Swan Song with Johnny Cash.
Right, I wasn't aware
which was a true story
on the Yours, Mine, and Theirs syllabus about the Columbo episode with Johnny Cash. But I'll let you talk about that all you want. Was it good?
Yeah, it was good. I mean, it's Columbo, right? He's the best. So,
do you know what show I've never seen one episode of?
Columbo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No! Oh my god.
Really?
It's really entertaining. I love Columbo.
Okay.
But yeah.
Were you never home from school and lying on the sofa in an afternoon, or at home on a rainy Sunday in the afternoon and there was nothing to do?
I'm never home from school, and when it's raining, I'm out. So I haven't seen Columbo. I don't know how to watch. How do you watch Columbo these days?
IMDb TV, which is free. You just click on imdb.com, and you look up Columbo, and you can watch many of the episodes, including Swan Song.
So are we going to watch an episode of Columbo to go along with the movies every time now?
I think that would improve the podcast.
Good idea.
No end.
I feel some new awards coming on. Okay. So I love Columbo because his MO is to like agree with the bad guy throughout the entire film, right? Like you must be right, and then at the end, because you can't get anything past Columbo, because there's always just something right that he needs tying up. Anyway. Yeah, Columbo's great, and Johnny Cash's hair in that episode is like its own character.
Oh, yeah, okay. Is it like Snake's hair, like from Simpsons?
Snake from The Simpsons?
Not
Snake Plissken. Yeah, it's similar to Snake's hair, I guess.
Okay. Well, you know what? As long as you're, I mean, do you want to just go ahead and sum up the Columbo episode and tell us what you think, and then we can talk about it? I can't say anything else about it. But Johnny Cash, was he one of the people we're talking about?
Yeah, Johnny Cash plays Johnny Cash in the episode, right? Basically, so he's a gospel singer. His wife, who looks too old for him, which is weird because Johnny Cash looks pretty old, controls his career and doesn't, you know, they don't really have a romantic relationship. And I think Johnny Cash's character has, the point is, she's making it so he can't have fun and make money. So he, like, it's the screwiest thing you've ever heard of, right? He's a pilot. He's got her in the airplane and he drugs her, and I guess his, is it his daughter? His sister? Who's the other girl? I have no idea who she is. There's another girl. Drugs them both so they fall asleep, and then he intentionally crashes the airplane with them in it, but he jumps out with a parachute just in time. He happens to land 2 feet away from the airplane, and then he, like, pretends to be unconscious because what he's attempting to do is make it look as though he was thrown from the airplane because he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and it saved his life. And but Columbo doesn't buy it. So,
is it in too bad taste to suggest that that's what Buddy Holly was attempting?
It's
trying to off the big bopper and Richie Valens.
That's an interesting take. Didn't pan out.
Yeah. So I think then Buddy Holly's parachute wasn't he didn't stuff it well or whatever, right? Yeah. So anyway, no, that's the Columbo episode.
But it sounds like the plot of Death Proof as well.
A little bit. So he the day of his wife's funeral, he doesn't attend. Instead, he has a bikini pool party. Not suspicious. But anyway, good times. Man, Columbo's the best. So, hey.
I must admit, you got me really wanting to watch the show.
So, you know, we watched Murder by Death, and Peter Falk is on it, and he's supposed to be playing Sam Spade. But he's more or less playing Columbo.
Okay.
So,
did Murder by Death inspire Columbo, or was it earlier?
Oh man, I think he was probably already making Columbo at that point.
Columbo Pilot was 67, I think.
Oh yeah, Murder by Death was like late 70s, right? Wow. Because it was right before Star Wars with Alec Guinness.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, okay. We actually really got into that episode. That's fine. I imagine. Okay, you sound lively. I imagine your new career isn't soul crushing yet.
I'm really enjoying it. And I've been like teleworking almost entirely. I wish though I could just go sit down in an office because it's just there's a lot of distractions in a house full of. Geez, what are we now? 7 + 6 people. The whole holy cow. There's 13 people in this house. But no, the work's good, and even better than the work is they're paying me way too much money, so everything's good. And I just learned, I guess what's making me really happy is the house that we're buying, the sellers are giving us an additional $5,000 seller credit, so yay!
I hope some of these people listen to the podcast so that they can, you know, squeeze you out of a little bit more money, because I don't know them, but they deserve it, and you don't.
Well... anyway.
Huh.
All right. But, you know, life's good, John. So.
I'll take your word for it. Yep. Phil, anything new since we talked? It's been a couple weeks.
Nothing new, which is good or bad, depending on how you look at things.
Sounds great to me.
Who likes new things? Yeah. I don't like new things.
No. Freaks me out. Gives me anxiety. You know, I'll talk to you guys about that, you know, some other time, you know. When I start my therapy podcast. Well, I guess we can talk about movies then. This will be an interesting trip. We should just say, you know, we're talking the Buddy Holly story and Backbeat and Respect. Actually, I'm just going to say it here before I forget. Phil, you didn't have a chance to watch Respect. Why is that?
That is because of differential release dates across continents, unfortunately.
Right. Respect comes out in, like, what, 8 days?
Something like that, yeah. London. A week tomorrow, yeah.
Yeah, which we did not anticipate, but totally fine. Yeah, it's as long as you know who Aretha Franklin is, you contribute to the conversation. You say how that movie should have been. But unfortunately, we didn't assign you respect. What did we assign?
Well, no, he's got Buddy Holly's Story. I've got Backbeat, John. You've got Respect. The rules.
I was supposed to.
Is them the rules? Respect. I thought I was doing Backbeat.
Yeah. Oh, well, no. So because you can't do the movie you chose.
No. That's the rule. You cannot do the movie you chose. You watched the Buddy Holly Story.
I did watch it.
Okay, so you can listen to my take on Backbeat, which is a beloved film of yours, I'll be good. But but the Respect, this is way too, if you've ever seen like an episode of Glee, right? Like it's a good episode if they're singing the songs you like. So like there's several points of the movie where she sings the songs, you know, and it's really great. And there's a little bit more to the movie than that, but that's a kind of an easy way to sum up that film.
Also, how much does that apply overall? I mean, isn't that kind of what biopics are? Waiting for song you like?
It is, and I will say, like, watching all three of these movies was such a pleasure. I mean, probably just because of, like, all the really great music, right? So these three movies were a lot of fun to watch.
Yes. Yeah, the awards category for best song is going to be a tough one.
Oh. Yeah, there's a lot of choices, but I think I'm content with my choice. So I guess that means, Phil, the Buddy Holly Story, it's all yours.
Okay. So I had never seen this before. Am I allowed to ask you what your history with this film / Buddy Holly is before I start? I knew virtually nothing about Buddy Holly other than someone who knows, you know, a bit about music. I know his big hits. I know the time he was alive. I know he died early. I know how he died. But that's about it.
I had never heard of this movie until John assigned the category, until like this was the category that won, and then I started looking into, okay, what movies can we do for this? And then I heard of this movie, and all I needed to see was Gary Busey as Buddy Holly.
Right, that's all I knew about this movie. I had never seen this
movie. We all came to it fresh. That's interesting. Yeah. I thought you guys were... This was like a regular Christmas tradition or something that you would watch this every year.
It's about to be. I rented it, but now I think I'm on the verge of buying it. I think I could watch this movie multiple times per year. But anyway.
Yeah. No, totally. Okay. All I know about Buddy Holly is I think maybe Buddy Holly was my dad's favorite musician. But since I never really knew my dad, I never got to hear I never heard the father and son, like, this is why Buddy Holly is great. I think the first thing I think of when I think of Buddy Holly, I don't think of a Buddy Holly song. I think of a Weezer song, because that's when I grew up.
Yes.
But that's pretty much what I got about Buddy Holly. And actually, most of what I know about Buddy Holly is seeing the 80s movie La Bamba about Ritchie Valens.
Yeah.
So. Okay, that's what I know.
Okay, so... film starts in a roller skating rink, which is an interesting place to start. Not something I'm familiar with. I don't think I've ever been in a roller skating rink. I've been in an ice rink a couple of times, but I don't know if that's a particularly American thing, but we don't have roller derby or roller disco or whatever. You
know, I didn't know that it was an American thing, but I guess now I would say that it is, because so John and I and another friend of ours, we did an overnight lock-in in a roller skating rink.
I actually wasn't there. You always mention that I'm there.
Oh, you weren't there. That night. Yeah. So me and a couple of my other friends, Jake Wilson, maybe Peter Ivy was there, from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m., we spent New Year's or something? Maybe it was New Year's.
You were held hostage because you couldn't leave.
It seemed like a good idea until 1 a.m. From 1 a.m. until 7 a.m., we were sitting on a bench staring at our feet. So, but anyway, yes, I guess roller rinks is an American thing.
Yeah, it's very American.
And, and you have live entertainment there, apparently. So we cut straight into Buddy Holly and his band, Not Yet the Crickets, who are going to be performing the entertainment. But it's also going to be live broadcast on the local radio station. And they play some kind of traditional schmaltzy number. Then they can't resist their rock and roll urges. And
they play that first number, I'm like, oh, crap, this movie's going to suck.
Weird, I didn't think it was that bad. I sort of was actually slightly relieved. I thought, oh, that's okay, actually. If the music's of that standard, then it won't be so bad. But then I was even more relieved when it got better.
Yeah.
And so they go into that, and the guy in the control room is has to field a call from an irate advertiser who doesn't want no bebop or whatever on on the station that he's advertising on. You better tell him to cut that out. And it's setting a kind of a pattern. The radio producer is really chill. And he's like, oh, well, I kind of like it, but, you know, I guess if you don't like it, then you don't have to listen to it. So he's sticking up for Buddy Holly already, which everyone throughout the movie will do, pretty much. But eventually I think they do get cut off. So there's a little bit of pushback from the establishment. So we're introduced to the idea that Buddy Holly is this visionary but very small-time player at the moment. He's in Lubbock, Texas, just a girl boy. And he's playing these songs that he's written that he believes in, and kind of nobody wants to know until immediately everybody wants to know. He goes to Nashville, I believe, where he's offered the chance to record some of his songs, but the stuffy stuffed shirts at Nashville don't right. dig his vibe.
It's like it's not redneck enough. They actually said that to him.
Did they actually say that?
No, they didn't. But
no, a hillbilly. He says we don't play hillbilly, doesn't he?
Well, yeah, Buddy Holly says I'm sick of this hillbilly stuff. Yeah.
And so he wants to produce it himself and have control, which he's not getting, and blah blah blah. So it doesn't work out for him terribly well. But a tape from what they have recorded, I think, escapes somehow and ends up at a radio station in New York, where some deranged, coked up DJ claims to have played it for 15 hours straight. I wonder if he just played it like 3 times, but he's just so off his nut.
Yeah,
it feels like it's been 15 hours. And then we're treated to a weirdly
strangely
slapstick
that
thing.
DJ was sacrificing his life.
he was under siege.
Was that important to him?
He was going
to
get taken out by those cops.
Yeah.
As soon as they picked themselves up off the floor, the cops who burst in.
Yeah.
through his barricade, they were gonna take him down. So this affords him some notoriety, and his career takes off, and he has another go at recording, and it goes a bit better. And during the second recording session, he becomes all flustered when he sees the woman of his dreams in the booth. Who then turns out to be, I'm right saying, she's the niece of the lady who owns the song publishing company attached to that studio or something like that.
Yeah.
She's a bigwig of some kind. And really, this is about an hour into the film, and at this point I was thinking, nothing's going wrong for this guy. It's all just great. Everyone's having a great time. Everyone's playing music, they love it, everyone loves him, they're all happy, his bandmates are really nice guys. And so I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be the first bit of pushback we're going to get, because he wants to date the niece, but she says, my aunt won't let me date anyone who's not Puerto Rican, I think she says. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, oh, okay, so is this where we're going to get a bit of grit in the oyster? Is this where things are going to get, we're going to have some conflict. They're going to have to sneak around, and maybe they'll get caught out, or they'll have to elope or something. But no, he just goes around to the aunt's house and says, I really like to date your niece, and I promise you I'm nice. And she says, sí, you are nice, so that's fine. And that's the end of that conflict.
Yeah, that was weird. I kind of wondered if she was trying to get out of dating Buddy Holly. Like if, I forgot her name already.
The aunt's like, I never would have a problem with this. What's my niece talking about?
Yeah. That's pretty much what she said, yeah. It's Maria, right? Maria?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know if this happens before or after that, but he goes on this, he's booked at the Apollo somewhere, where I guess it's traditionally a very, because this is another motif in the film. Everywhere it goes, they assume, having heard the music, that they are black artists. And he gets booked to play in this place that's traditionally a very black venue, and everyone's like, oh my goodness, what are you doing? It's going to be a disaster. No one white has ever played there. I'm going to... Does the organizer say, I'm going to get lynched? A white man's going to get lynched or something? There's a slight unsavory comment.
That sounds pretty familiar, yeah. I think he said it kind of like, I acknowledge the irony of myself saying this, but I think...
Yeah. But it was pushing the grounds of political correctness. But what do you know, because this is the Buddy Holly story, everyone loves him, and it's just an unmitigated success. There's a sharp intake of breath at first, but, you know, by the time he's two bars into his first number, he's won over the crowd, and then they all get up
it's
and
like
start
Rocky
dancing.
Four.
Yeah.
And then just randomly, Sax King Curtis just appears stage left, and he's just like, King Curtis, everybody! And everyone's just having a great time, because everything goes right for Buddy Holly in this universe. But then we do get the first little bit of, first and last little bit of tension, which is the burgeoning success of the band, causes some tension within the band. And it's hinted at very gently, but I think we're supposed to conclude that his drummer and his bass player, well, especially his drummer, are getting a little bit jealous. They think he's maybe a bit big for his boots, that he's becoming too much the focal point, as they sort of get TV exposure and what have you. They start to understand that he's more into this than they are. And then so we have this, you know, absolute traditional, debauched, violent, horrible rock and roll confrontation whereby they come off stage and one of them says, well, I guess I'll go home to the hotel and change, and the other one says, bye. And that's it. That's the latest bit of conflict in this tense.
There is an accidental headbutting.
But even that is, you know, that could have been a fist fight. Why didn't they make it a fist fight?
It turned out pretty nice. It's like, oh, bullseye. Like, that's it, right? Like, no one loses their temper at all.
So he's very successful. The guys go back home to Lubbock, Texas, because they just want to be at home. And he carries on, becomes a star. He goes into a bit of producing. But he's still very young. This is, he's like 22 when he dies, spoiler alert. So he's achieved a lot very young. And he's even got to the point, even age 21, 22, where he's kind of not burnt out exactly, but he doesn't want to tour anymore. He's kind of a bit tired of it. He wants to do some less demanding promotional work. And by now he's settled down with the niece, Maria, whatever she's called. It's weird to think that the film is trying to sort of tell us by this point, oh, he's an old hand, he's a bit burnt out, he's a bit nervous. He's only 22. It's kind of, I mean, maybe that is the case in the music industry. Who knows? It is that brutal that it chews you up and spits you out that young. I'm sure that does happen. But then he decides he will, after he has a lovely, lovely, lovely scene where he teaches some cherubic young children how to play an E chord, he decides he will go back out on the road and plays a wonderful gig at what's called Clear Lake or Lake View or something like that. But their tour bus has broken down a couple of times because of the terrible weather, so he decides he's going to book a flight instead.
So, does that make sense? Like, the weather's so bad we can't drive, so let's fly.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. I mean, I've never been a happy flyer, but...
How well do you guys remember the movie La Bamba?
Decently well. So the last scene of La Bamba before he gets on the airplane sure seems a lot different than the last scene of this film.
Right. I mean, I don't know what's true or whatever, but they...
Right, so it's like a Rashomon thing. We're seeing it from two
perspectives. Yeah, because the bus didn't... From my understanding, what I remember of La Bamba, the bus doesn't break down, but the heating in the bus broke or something.
The heater's broken.
Yes.
Right. And
yeah.
So they would go across, and so some of them, there was the fateful coin flip. And a big thing about La Bamba, and this probably isn't true, is that Richie Valens was afraid of flying. but they kind of convinced him to do the coin flip because the conditions would be so bad, you know, driving in the bus. And so, like, the whole tour, so, like, all the musicians weren't on the plane. It was just the three musicians and the pilot, right? The three musicians who died. But then the other people actually did take the broken down bus. Mm-hmm. And so, so it wasn't, like, broken down. They still used it. It was just who went where.
So the person who lost the coin flip in La Bamba was Albert Goldman.
Yes.
Who went on to become the fifth Beatle. So
yeah, we're going to get to that. I was going to say, this is one thing I meant to... I thought about summing up these differently this time. It's too late now, obviously. We're doing our old thing that we always do. But we could have done, like, by year. We could have started in... 1952, and then ended in, I think, like
62
or whatever. Yeah, 1960. Well, 1972 technically, with respect, because it's a little bit broader. But it's, you know, it's within the kind of this specific 10-year window that all of these events happen. So it kind of works out. There's a lot of overlap here. So
So just to finish my summing up. That's it. We then get the not quite fade to black. We get a freeze frame at the end of his successful concert, and it says, "Oh, by the way, he then died."
Yeah.
End of film.
Yeah.
Was that a shock, guys? I was expecting like the airplane scene, right? But they just ended on like this final great concert, right, where he makes a point of playing that song that he wrote for his wife, But so if you watch through the credits, like it slowly zooms in on his face, and then at the end of the credits, all you can like, you all it shows is like one of his eyes and half of his nose. It's like super close in.
The ending is kind of. Remember a few years ago, the Cumberbatch movie, The Imitation Game,
The Imitation Game. Yeah.
Right. The guy who invented the computer that was a code breaker for World War II, right? Mm. And
Alan Turing.
Yeah, and Phil, did you see that?
I haven't seen it. I know a lot about Alan Turing, but I've never seen the film.
Okay, so you probably know, like, in the film. I'm sorry, I'm going to tell you about this film, but you already know about him, so it's fine.
I know what happens to Alan Turing in the end, if you're worried.
The whole movie is just like he's inventing this computer, he goes through this, he makes this friend, he makes that friend, and then at the very end of the movie it says, okay, by the way, Alan Turing was a homosexual and the powers that be did not like that, and so they chemically castrated him. And it says that in the words at the end of the movie. So it's kind of like weirdly like the Buddy Holly story, like the biggest event is just
right. And if you're going to call your film The Buddy Holly Story, that is a weird point to stop telling the story, because you nearly finished it. You might as well finish it.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know if I hate it, because, like, especially as you were talking, I thought this is such a funny little story, because even the conflict, even the bumps in the road are very smoothed over in this movie.
Absolutely.
And so I think maybe the point of that, maybe they kind of showed the bumps pretty smooth in the movie to kind of accentuate the tragedy of it all. The fact that, he did so much and he was so great and he was going to get back together with a band and he had a kid on the way and he was the love of his life, and then just suddenly, just with words, by the way, he died suddenly.
Yeah, you say he had a kid on the way, and from what I read on Wikipedia, when his wife found out that he died, she miscarried. So it's horrible. So, like, I don't expect them to have a scene where, you know, they're on the plane and they're going down and they're praying and, you know, it's horrific or what have you, but it just seemed odd to not do it. But then, like you say, I didn't hate it because it had been so light, because there was such an absence of conflict. I think by the time you're about half an hour in, you think, okay, we're doing this. We're doing, it's just a happy thing. We're celebrating this guy. We just want a nice, light, happy film. Isn't this great? Maybe it's a shame that he died, but don't get hung up on that. Think of the happy times. So, and at first I couldn't, early on I couldn't work out which way it was, whether the true story was much darker. I mean, we know it ends dark, but I don't know anything about his life. Like I said, I don't know what the truth is. I couldn't work out whether perhaps his true life story was a lot darker and they were massaging it out to be smoother and happier, or his life was so squeaky clean and so free of conflict that even the bits they did put in, they kind of had to exaggerate to make any kind of tension. So I really don't know which is the truth, but the fact that he ignored the death entirely, well, not ignored, but do you know what I mean? Kind of told me, look, we just want to celebrate this guy. And I kind of like that. I mean, we'll see what a big contrast it will be to Backbeat in terms of its tone.
So I liked it too, honestly. And so, if you're watching this movie, I don't want to say that it's impossible to watch this movie and not know how it ends beforehand, right? But I'm pretty sure most people knew who Buddy Holly is. And,
but if you
and
didn't, my God, that ending.
Yeah. And you know how it's going to end. But like some of these parts of the, like, there's some parts of the movie where they introduce tension that didn't exist in real life. So, for example, like his parents kind of being against his rock and rolling is not true. His mom actually helped him write Maybe Baby.
Really?
Yeah. So, I don't know. It's like doing like the dark biopic on Jimmy Stewart, right? And then you find out that, oh, no, he was just a decent guy. Yeah, or like, I don't know if you've watched the Netflix show on Bob Ross, and you go into it going, okay, this is going to be super controversial, and it's like, no, not really. And it turns out, like, the worst thing you learn about him is that he permed his hair, that the hair was a lie, right?
What?
And so, yeah. But so what I think of, though, is, do you remember there was a version of Les Miserables with Uma Thurman and... what's his head?
Qui-Gon Jinn.
Liam Neeson, right? And the movie ends immediately after Jeffrey Rush commits suicide, and like Jean Valjean, you know, he's happy, he's relieved, he smiles, movie's over, right? So that's a cheat. That's cheating. But I thought the way this movie ended was just fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think because it lets you, it wears its colors on its sleeve, doesn't it? It's letting you know from the word go, look, this is a nice, happy story. And I don't mind if... I don't mind things that are honest about what they're going to do and then lean into it heavily. Even if it's not what I would have done or not my ideal story, I think, well, good for you for deciding that's the way we're going to do it, and we're just going to do it, and we're going to stick by it. And they do stick by it.
So the tension in this movie, though, that I do feel is because Gary Busey's playing Buddy Holly, and every now and then, like in like a smile or like a look or something, like, oh, he could kill someone on set right now.
Yeah,
and I'm you're just waiting for something to happen, but no, I mean I agree with you. I mean, I think the movie is supposed to be fun and a celebration, and it was. So,
and now that you mention it, though, the choice of Gary Busey, and this is hindsight reasoning because we know he's a lunatic.
Okay,
but it just seems a little bit like, okay, maybe. And I think that was the appeal of this movie. Just like, what? Gary Busey is Buddy Holly? Buddy Holly's supposed to be squeaky clean, and Gary Busey is, you know, constantly in a ditch somewhere.
Okay, now that's interesting, because this is something I had already planned to ask you, and now I'm extra curious. Is that, as well as not knowing really about Buddy Holly, I don't know anything about Gary Busey, but from what I've picked up of, you know, through American culture, is he's kind of a punchline to some degree, or at least there's a very strong cultural reference point for Americans, Gary Busey, that I don't think exists.
Yeah,
he's like Nicolas Cage before Nicolas Cage.
Okay.
Yeah, but he's like in the...
Did he get brain damage? Am I right? I looked at his Wikipedia, and is that why
that's a thing, too. Yeah. So, he didn't have, like... Okay, you probably know more officially, but, you know, way back when, during the Buddy Holly story, you know, I suppose... Yeah, everything's fine, but I think he was in some serious motorcycle accidents. So, and I don't know. I don't think his medical records are public or anything. But I mean,
another interesting layer on watching this is I knew Gary Busey was a thing that Americans know about, and everyone has like a story or a joke about Gary Busey. But maybe it's just me, but I don't think on this side of the Atlantic he is a cultural touchstone in the way he is over there.
Is
so I think
Point
this
Break
might be my first.
There?
No, Point Break is, but I haven't seen it. This is something that keeps coming up on this podcast. Is I haven't seen any films.
Check out Point Break, man. Oh, I love that movie.
Well, and he's a great villain in the Lethal Weapon, the original Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, yeah.
He's pretty.
Well, I have
good.
Seen
he's
that, but not
good,
for a very long time.
Yeah.
He's
the one that Mel Gibson has the shirtless fight in the street with the. with the fire hydrant spraying water all over him, and it's glorious. If I remember right, right? Yeah.
So yeah, it is. So it's sad though, because like someone like Gary Busey, like if we're assuming he has brain damage from a motorcycle accident or whatever, like I don't know if it's in order for him to keep making money or whatever, but now we, like, he's just kind of lumped in with like Tonya Harding and like Corey Feldman and kind of like the D-list actors who like they continue to make money because everyone knows they're a joke, and we're kind of exploiting them for laughs, right? And it's kind of sad.
Well, I'll say this for him, and I, not knowing anything about him, and I believe he made this film before a lot of his problems, but I mean, what a performance.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, the film, I didn't want to come down too hard on this film. I was thinking of all kinds of sort of little jokes and zings I could make about this film that would sort of make it sound as if I didn't like it, but the truth is, I really enjoyed it. I do think, you know, it's crucially lacking in conflict, and there's bits you can make fun of, but for certainly the first two thirds, maybe the last third drags a little bit, and you need a bit more grit in the oyster, but for most of it I was happy to go with it, and I really enjoyed it, and he just absolutely commits to the role, and you know, I've read he's playing the instruments, he's playing the guitar, they're all playing their instruments, they're all singing
and singing,
and
yeah,
I don't know what Buddy Holly was really like, so I don't know that it's a wonderful but accurate portrayal of Buddy Holly. But it's a wonderful portrayal of somebody, whether it's the real Buddy Holly or not. It's a great performance, I think.
Yeah,
so I don't think he looks that much like Buddy Holly, but like he is like you said, he is like 110% in, right? Like he is so committed to the role, and it's just he does an incredible job.
Yeah,
so
this, like I said, the
high mark
the
of
film leans into the style that it's going for, and I can respect that. If something really knows what it's doing and leans into it, I can respect that. And so Gary Busey does the same thing in the role. He knows what he's doing. He really goes for it, and I think he really succeeds. Whether he succeeds in being Buddy Holly, I don't know. Don't know Buddy Holly that well, but he gives a magnetic performance, I think.
I believe he was nominated for an Oscar.
Right.
Yeah. And so like, this movie's 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, and so when you read the reviews, a lot of them are like, well, there's some inaccuracies here in the film, but the one thing that no critic can deny is Gary Busey just kills it as Buddy Holly.
Now, I have a hard time. I was okay after I watched this. I have a hard time explaining this because I don't know. It's just weird. But the movie kind of has a look, kind of a made-for-TV sort of look. It's not super extraordinary.
Yeah.
But there's something about it. Like if I watched this movie, and let's just say I'd never heard of Buddy Holly, and I had watched this movie, I would kind of. It's kind of presented as just a straight up movie, you know, like it's not, it doesn't feel like a biopic. Strangely, there's something about it where it just kind of feels like, okay, we're telling this story of a guy, and it feels to me like a standard. It's so hard for me to explain because it sounds like I'm putting the movie down, but I'm doing the opposite of that for some reason.
Right.
It's not bound by the normal things that we kind of expect from musical biopics, where it's like, okay, this happens, and this happens, and then this happens. And it does that, but it kind of feels like a fictional movie rather than a real movie. And I feel like that's sort of like weirdly refreshing, where it like this feels like a story in someone's mind that they made up rather than... Oh, yes. I'm obligated to tell these story beats that actually happened. And I don't know. I kind of like it. It sounds like I'm kind of being mean to it, but I kind of like it.
That was exactly my reaction. That's so interesting that you're saying the same thing. Was so many, all the things I thought to say about it would sound like I'm having a go at it or I'm making fun of it. And maybe I am in a good-natured way, some of them. But I really, really enjoyed it. And I'm laughing with it. I think it knows what it's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more a movie than a history, and I think I like that.
And loads of songs. It was not afraid. It was almost a musical. You know, it starts off in the roller skating ring with I think at least two, perhaps three, like full songs, not like snippets or cut down versions of songs, but full songs. And that then goes on when they play at the Apollo, and then when he plays at the end, it's a bit more of a medley at the end. But there's a lot of music in it, and that just sort of adds to the feeling that it's a celebration, because they're not afraid to just put a lot of the music in it in a very positive way and show him happy and performing and excited and audience is responding. It's a celebration in a much more positive way than another film we're going to talk about in a second.
Hmm. Yeah, totally. And also, it's funny that, you know, we talk about, you know, did they smooth out some of the conflicts and some of the grit of this movie, or did they add the grit?
Mm.
It's if I were to, I mean, because apparently if you do the research, you know, if you check the IMDb trivia, and it kind of says like, well, actually, you know, they were supportive, and actually you didn't have this problem here. If I didn't do that and I watched this movie, I thought for sure that they smooth things out, you know, for a specific thing. But it's kind of weird that the opposite is true. So.
Yeah,
it's wholesome. It's nice. It's nice to watch a film that's wholesome for once, and full of nice people, largely doing nice things, and you know the racial relations are all positive and wonderful, and they don't feel the need to throw too much conflict into that. Even we just everyone's good, everyone means well, and the moments where people don't mean well are very minor and glossed over. Yeah. It's very comforting. I can't say it's going to be on hard rotation in my house, but I was really glad to have watched it.
So the truth is like, I'm dying to watch this with my kids, and also I'm kind of dying to watch this with my dad. But I really enjoyed it. And by the way, noise update, I'm now back outside near the air conditioner because everyone has come home, and I just can't tell people to be quiet. So
what?
Yeah, we'll call this the air conditioner podcast.
All right, that's fine. Yeah, we'll do that. We'll do that.
Want me to go turn off their air conditioning? Maybe they won't notice for an hour.
I think you put a lantern. Thanks for putting a lantern on us. So listeners, all right, we're just acknowledging it. There's going to be no audio quality this time. Also, I'm not going to bother editing as hard. So there's
a good segue here because we just talked about Buddy Holly, and his band is Buddy Holly and the Crickets, and it's not a coincidence that we're now talking about the Beatles, because the Beatles did take their name from Buddy Holly and the Crickets. Of course, they changed the spelling of Beatle, right? Because it's funner that way.
They should have called themselves the Back Beatles.
The Back Beatles. Okay, so Backbeat is the story about the Beatles in their very, very early days, right? When they're struggling, like they can't really afford a decent venue, so they go to Hamburg to kind of get things rolling a little bit, and from what I can tell, like, they are the B act, and the A act is all the 1960s Hamburg strippers. But they get in on the action a little bit too, and they wear they don't wear pasties, but they got some fun outfits. So anyway, they're just playing in this club in Hamburg. Stuart Sutcliffe is with them. You have Peter Best as the drummer. And they're staying in this crappy place where they're all bunk bedded up, which leads to some hilarity when they're enjoying the company of ladies. Privacy's not a problem for them. In fact, they're able to like give each other commentary, so that's pretty cool.
Right, well, wasn't it like Paul McCartney said...
Yes, I was just going to mention this.
Right, he said just this last year that he and John used to enjoy just masturbating in front of each other back in those days.
I was going to be more subtle than that, because I know you guys like to keep it family friendly.
I know, I wanted to be, I just felt like, oh, maybe I should just be clinical about this.
It sounded like a whole story about, I think, not just him and John, but like a group of guys sat in the dark in a circle.
Oh.
All jerking off.
Right.
That's friendship.
That's and the
He just sort of mentioned jerks. It in an interview as if, like, everyone does it.
Yeah, like, what?
Well, you know,
are you looking
like
at me that way? What?
In a darkened room with a load of guys in a circle, and you're all just tugging yourselves off to see who can come first.
There's no cable TV back then.
So I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wasn't going to, but I really wanted to.
So, anyway, at the club they're playing at in Hamburg, a man comes and watches them and becomes a fan of theirs, and this is Klaus. And Klaus's girlfriend is Astrid, and Astrid is a photographer. And, well, she goes on to photograph them in Hamburg and kind of during their early career, and it's kind of a big part of the Beatles, right? But the problem, there's two problems here. One, Stuart Sutcliffe sucks at the bass and at performing, and the rest of the Beatles recognize it, but he's John Lennon's best friend. And John says multiple times, if Stu's out, I'm out, right? So they can't get rid of him. He's not any better at the trombone than he is at the bass. They let him like do a solo performance, and it happens to be he does an Elvis song, right? It happens to be at the same time that the guy from, is it from Polydor Records, comes to check out their act, and he just like walks in and turns right back around.
Yeah, Stu's version of Love Me Tender is, it reminds me a lot of Sid Vicious's version of My Way.
Yeah. Anyway, so there's one of the conflicts. Stu's not very good, and I think Stu recognizes he's not very good. Stu's an amateur artist, and that's kind of more his thing. And then he falls in love with Astrid, and there's kind of the idea that maybe John liked her too, but Stu gets her, and much to Klaus's chagrin, although like Klaus, like the whole courtship happens right in front of him, and he seems like really chill about it. Until like, you know, Stu and Astrid enjoy each other's company in her apartment, and Stu comes home, and there's, I'm going to call it the robe incident, right? You just can't get past the robe
gate.
The robe gate. So anyway, long story short, I think I can sum this up pretty quickly. The Beatles start to get noticed. They start to get bigger and bigger. They're still mostly playing like Chuck Berry songs, and do we have any Buddy Holly songs in this movie?
I don't think so, but they certainly did play.
They did, yeah.
And the earliest known recording of any of the Beatles is 1958, John Lennon singing That'll Be the Day.
Oh, that's fascinating. So so one of the songs the Beatles, they've got a song that I thought was theirs for the longest time, and only while watching the Buddy Holly story did I realize it's not theirs. And I'm gonna have to look it up because it's driving me crazy. So you're just gonna have to just bear with me.
Look it up.
But it's, yeah, I'm looking it up. Let me pull up my Buddy Holly album, my Buddy Holly Greatest Hits album, because I'm a schoolgirl. Words of Love, right? I think on one of the Beatles albums they cover Words of Love.
Yes, they do. Yeah. Yep. I think with the Beatles in 64, possibly.
Yeah, I think you're right. So anyway, it basically comes out that he's done with the Beatles. The Beatles know he's done with the Beatles. John's the only one who still hasn't accepted it, but he kind of, they have this fight. It's like, it's this new martial arts style called hug fighting. pretty intense. And then there's just kind of this climactic moment where they're all having a good time this evening at looks like a lighthouse, a beach at a lighthouse, and John has the line that they repeated in the trailer for Backbeat, and where John says, like, you know, you're gonna say one day I could have been a Beatle, and Stu, like, you know, he's just not that put off by it. And then also, like,
wouldn't,
when he has,
wouldn't
the talk
it be
with
something Ant- if you were watching this for the first time and you kind of didn't know the names of the Beatles, right? you didn't know John, Paul, George, and then it was like an hour into the movie and you got that line where he's like, he could have been one of the Beatles, and you go, oh, these are the Beatles.
These are the Beatles.
Yeah. Because it doesn't say Beatles until then, I don't
think. That's true.
I think you're right, because I'm like, have they called themselves the Beatles at this point? Are they going to, like, say it at some point?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's the first time you hear him say the Beatles, right? And so Astrid has the same conversation with him, like, someday you're going to resent me. Someday you're going to regret this. And he's like, nope, I really won't. Even if they become huge, I won't. And then to seal the door shut, right, or whatever, right, to seal the deal, to make sure that there's no way he feels regret and tries to rejoin the Beatles, he dies of a brain aneurysm.
Right. God didn't want him to regret not being in the Beatles.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can still view his art, right? I understand that. And so I mind. So we meet Ringo Starr in this movie. I don't. Do we even see him, or is it just referenced? He's the lump laying in the cot over there.
Yeah, like his back is to us. Like, there are a few big reaches in references. Was that kind of annoying for you?
Oh, there's one that makes me so mad, and I'm going to save it for my awards, but there's one that just makes me so angry.
Okay,
but anyway,
we'll
Phil, let me ask you.
Yeah.
John Lennon's accent. Is that a good accent? I mean, is this a British guy? Because it just sounds like, as my bad American ear, I'm like, that's the worst John Lennon accent I've ever heard. But, you know,
because like, everybody does John Lennon, right? We all know. We all say anything you can imagine. Yeah.
Well, are you done with your sum up, Roy?
More or less. I do want to say, though, that so do we hear them perform a single Beatles song that's written by the Beatles? They played Twist and Shout at the Cellar. That's one of their big things. But Twist and Shout, they didn't write that either.
Yeah, no, I don't think there are any original Beatles songs, which I think is the reason they made this movie, because they're like, hey, we can make a Beatles movie, but we don't have to, we could do it where we don't have to pay, and we can do this gimmick where, you know, where the musicians are, present-day musicians, and I kind of want to talk about that in a minute. But, yeah, so I don't think there are any originals.
It's interesting to me, because I watched the movie, and I'm like, these guys are a bunch of knuckleheads. How on earth do they become the most brilliant band of all time? And so, cards on the table, Phil, the Beatles are my favorite band, and it's not even close.
Hey, wait. Okay. Really quick, I have to mention this. I just looked up Ian Hart, the guy who plays John Lennon. In his IMDb biography, the first thing it says is Ian Hart, comma, born in England, comma, began acting while a student in Liverpool, England.
Well, then, I guess, so Phil, it's a good accent?
Yes, it's a good accent.
Okay.
So two-part question. Well, no, one-part question, and then I'll talk about accents. And you've just mentioned Roy, but what is you guys' Beatles background? Like, I asked you about Buddy Holly, and you were both a bit lukewarm, but I'm assuming the Beatles you're a bit more super fans of.
So John hates the Beatles, but I love them. Yeah. So my background is
Rolling Stones are far superior to your Beatles.
That's
inaccurate and not funny.
Phil, that's the second time I've said that joke in your presence, and you said the same thing. Except I reversed it. I said our Beatles are far superior to your Rolling Stones.
All right. So, with my parents, we would do vacations, and they were always road trips to Yellowstone or California or whatever. And we had three tapes. We had a Linda Ronstadt tape, we had a Chuck Berry concert, and we had the Beatles' greatest hits. And so as a kid, I memorized at least two tapes worth of Beatles songs, and I really enjoyed them as a kid. And then it kind of, I mean, there's that anchoring bias where it's something that's sentimental, right? But then as an adult, and I continued to listen to the Beatles, so I'm not a huge fan of Yellow Submarine, but Yellow Submarine, that album aside, every album is really good. For them to produce that much consistently really high quality music over the span of 7 or 8 years is just astonishing. And I have a playlist of Beatles songs, but I haven't curated it. It's just everything from the Beatles, and I can hit play and I'm good. So I love the Beatles, and probably too much, but I think John is lukewarm.
I don't hate the Beatles. I must say, and I don't have an exhaustive knowledge of the Beatles. I haven't listened to every Beatles album, but I'll just say, as a casual Beatles fan and a great respecter of the music of the Beatles, I'm more inclined toward mid 60s, Revolver era.
Yep.
That's kind of what I most gravitate to. But I'm not a Beatles expert. I really like Norwegian Wood, and I like that one song that sounds really weird on Revolver, and I like Helter Skelter a lot, in that area. Those are the Beatles that I mostly am gravitating toward. Yeah.
So for a while, Across the Universe was my favorite song in the whole world. Still really like it. Although I've kind of rebounded, and now I think my favorite current Beatles song is I've Just Seen a Face.
Yeah.
And I love that song. I love that song so much.
Oh,
but there's
nice.
And so we podcasted about the movie It's a Hard Day's Night, and we talked about it, and we said it's only my fifth favorite Beatles album, but it's maybe the fifth best album of all time. So, I really enjoy the Beatles. I think they're great. I think I love all eras of the Beatles, and there was a while where I didn't like the early stuff, and I had a friend who's like, no, you know what? It's still high quality. It's a different genre, right? They were doing a different thing, but they did it really well. So anyway, I'm done fanboying. So this is where you tell us that even though you picked this movie, you think they're just the worst.
No, I think they're great. I would say I'm something of a Beatles expert, by which I mean I was certainly in my youth or my late teens, early 20s, I was a bit of a Beatles obsessive, and I've forgotten a lot of it now, but it might... to invoke an old cliche that might be true, I have probably forgotten more about the Beatles than most people have ever known. I was very, very obsessed. I've probably read most of the biographies of the Beatles collectively and a lot of the ones individually, to the point where, you know, I was reading the books about what they were doing in the studio every day throughout the 60s. You know, 18th of May 1965, George came in to do a kazoo overdub on this song kind of level. So I am somewhat obsessive. So the first thing to say is the accents are good. Obviously, Ian Hart is Liverpudlian, and his accent is good. I don't know if he sounds exactly like John Lennon, but his accent is legit. And I think they all are. I think the guy playing Paul is very well cast. And even George, to some extent. I think the guy playing George, given that it's a plot point in the film that he is 17 going on 18, is it me or does he look about 34?
Oh yeah, they all look really old to me.
But there's definitely an aura of legitimacy, relatively speaking. I've seen a lot worse. So I think it's the film has got grit in the oyster. It's got, and that's kind of key to the Beatles story and the Liverpudlian story, and we can talk about this some more, but that's where it's so different from the Buddy Holly movie, is that it does not shy away from the grit and the dirt that is kind of integral to the Beatles and their early years, and the drugs and the jealousy and the infighting and the struggle.
So I wonder if, like, the conflict that they experienced during this early point of their career was necessary for them to become what they were. Like, if Stu had kept with the band, would they have just never gone beyond, like, playing in small clubs? I don't know. So, but
probably,
yeah. So it's fascinating. So I look at all the Beatles in the film, and I look at Stewart, and it kind of feels like Stewart could also easily be in a movie set in the 90s, like the guy who plays Stewart.
Well, Stephen Dorff was king of the 90s.
Stephen Dorff, yeah. So the haircut and the sunglasses, and so I don't know. Maybe that worked in the 60s as well. I think, John, you used to promulgate a theory, right, as far as fashion and music and hair and clothing, that there were 30-year cycles, right?
Yeah, I gave up on that theory because once 2000 hit, I don't know what's going on. But that's probably just me being old, huh?
Yeah, it could be.
Because when do we get the 80s again? Weren't we supposed to have the 80s again in...
The 2010s? It didn't feel very 80s.
Yeah. But the 2010s, I guess they had just a little bit of everything, you know. That's a weird thing. I don't know how kids, you know, get by these days, like, culturally. Because, I mean, you know, when you think of the 2010s, you just, like, think of just, you know, just scattered, just randomness. You know, nothing that really identifies it, because we had everything, which is unfortunate, but I don't know. Yeah. I digress. It was funner being a kid back in the 90s than today, I assume. Sorry, kids. That's just a guess. I don't know. What was I going to ask about the Beatles? Okay, so, Phil, I got to ask. So, do you have a favorite Beatle?
Not really, but, you know, I stick up for Paul. I think one of the problems Paul had with this film was that they said they'd taken his rock and roll from him, by which he meant that John is the only singer pretty much in this film, apart from the you know, the harmony backup vocals, and I think Paul objected to that, as being, you know, painted as just this kind of...
Oh, you mean like Paul McCartney's actual commentary on the movie Backbeat?
Yeah, I believe so. I think he specifically objected. Well, I mean, that's kind of telling about Paul. What he objected to was that he wasn't the lead singer in any of the songs. Not so much, you know, a commentary on the times or his friends or the relationships, but just, oh, I sang that song, and they're saying that John sang that song.
Yeah.
So I had a discussion with my brother-in-law, because he knew I was going to do this podcast, and I was watching Backbeat, about like who the primary creative genius in the Beatles was, right? And I thought that, I told him that, like, growing up and for a long time, I always kind of sided with John, right? But so the question that he asked me was, okay, when the band broke up, whose solo career was better, right? And it's yes. Paul's by a long shot.
I mean, it's Paul's by a long shot, but I always thought, you know, when you think about like stuff like Imagine and Instant Karma and just stuff like that, I don't know, I guess it wasn't more popular, but I mean, the individual songs, don't you like John's songs a little bit better? Except for maybe Baby I'm Amazed, maybe, I don't know.
He's got a couple hits, right? But like, I think Paul's stuff is just really consistently good.
Well, I always think of that Simpsons, right, where someone said, okay, yeah, this person's a great manager. He got Paul McCartney out of Wings. And then Homer goes, what? No, he was the best one.
Or, do you guys know Alan Partridge?
Partridge the
Family
Coogan
television show?
Steve Coogan, yeah. Okay, so, yeah. Well, we could do a whole other episode on that, but there's a moment where he's asked, he mentions that one of his favorite albums is Wings' Greatest Hits. And the guy says, "Who's Wings?" And he says, "They're only the band the Beatles could have been."
So I mean, none of these side projects were as good as the Beatles. So whether whatever John's contribution was or Paul, right? Like, it's the combination of all of it that made the Beatles what they were. And I still enjoy John Lennon's stuff and Paul's stuff, but the Beatles were great.
Well, all those okay. Sorry, we're not talking about the movie at all, right?
No, we're not. And before you get back to the movie, right? Like, can you think of a band that was imploding in real time and puts out a record like Abbey Road, right?
Like, well, I mean,
they can barely talk to each other and they produce Abbey Road. It's just,
I mean, the Rolling Stones, they were all like sleeping with each other's wives to get back at each other, and somehow they, like, I guess all of that, just forged. You know, through that fire, it's like, well, the Rolling Stones can never be apart now because they're living through hell together, it seems like. But I do have a question, who was the driving force? They have, like, most of the music is penned Lennon-McCartney.
Yeah.
But do you guys have, like, I mean, can you sort by song? It's like, okay, this one's a Lennon, this one's a McCartney, this one's a Lennon. Because my understanding is they mostly wrote as individuals, but they put Lennon McCartney. Yes. But why correct. Was it that if they wrote all the songs, why were the Beatles songs so much better than their solo stuff if they were doing the individual writing?
Possibly because they had they were afraid of criticism from the other.
Yeah,
because there was an element of friction in that relationship.
So they had too much freedom outside of the.
Yeah, well, and they were probably surrounded by yes men at that point, but they were people who'd grown up together since, you know, mid teenage years, and who wouldn't hold back on what they thought of each other. And that it's well documented, the competitive element between the two of them drove them on. But once you're free of that and you're a multimillionaire, you can just do what you like.
And is it mostly the vocalist who is the primary songwriter?
Yeah.
Okay.
I will say, like, though, I think George gets short shrift, and I will say one of my very, very favorite songs is Something from Abbey Road, and that's a good old George Harrison song.
Yep.
Yeah, George Harrison is like the, what is it, the John Deacon, I guess, of the Beatles. What was John Deacon, right? John Deacon? Because, you know, he...
He was a bass player. Yeah, he wrote One Bites the Dust and stuff.
He wrote Another One Bites the Dust and I Want to Break Free, and I think he only wrote like four or five songs because, you know, all the members wrote like the songs, but like every one of his songs was like, okay, that's a classic Queen song.
Okay, so I'm gonna try and pull it back to Backbeat now with this
leading
question. No, go ahead, Roy.
It's a movie, yeah.
That movie we watched, go ahead.
I know you guys are big music fans. Were you ever in a band, either individually or together?
Nah. I can't play anything.
That's laugh. Yeah, no, I'm a bad music person.
John had some sexy sax going on, though, in high school.
I played saxophone, you know, for a couple years, you know, just like in school. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to start a ska band? And I think I could play like a couple of sort of ska type thing, like, you know, like there were a couple songs where there was like a horn part where I could play like two or three bars. Played piano. I t- took guitar lessons, but I could nothing could ever come together. And I was always like with people who wanted to start bands, but I was always the weak link.
So, Phil, you know Oingo Boingo, right?
No.
Okay, never mind. So they're a band, and they're an American band that had a heavy horn section for a while, and then they became Boingo. So I guess Oingo was the horn section. I'm just gonna make a bad joke that John wasn't in the horn section of Oingo Boingo, but I've now explained it
good
far
joke.
Too much.
Excellent joke, Ryan.
Yep.
So the reason I ask is because one of the things that I loved about the Beatles, and then I made a new friend in my early 20s, and I was delighted that they had the same experience when we talked about the Beatles, which was, you know, it's not just the music, which is largely great, although, you know, I'm the first to admit there are some clunkers in their catalog.
Yeah.
But it's the story. If the more you read, the more intrigued you will become, because it's this very human story of, like I say, people who were kids, teenagers, growing up together, infighting, heartache, jealousy, then becoming globals. They were like the first really, really famous bands. So there was Elvis and what have you beforehand, or indeed Buddy Holly, who, as we've seen, was a bit divorced from his band by the time he got famous. They were kind of the first globally famous group. And so it's just a fascinating study, their relationships, their development from working class kids in Liverpool to being global superstars. And for me, that's as much a part of the legend of the Beatles as the music.
Yeah.
So I think that's why I really enjoy watching Backbeat.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not putting the boot into the Buddy Holly story, but like we've said, it's two radically different views of the music industry.
Yeah.
In one, you know, things are largely going fine, there's no conflict. You know, he eventually breaks up with his band guys, but then it's all pretty amicable. And here we're seeing the opposite, which is the, you know, the ambition and the drive and the graft and the hideous working conditions and the stuff you have to go through as a band to make it. And to me, that's always been a crucial part of the Beatles story. You know, quite apart from any of the music is the relationships of those guys, you know, four working class kids from Liverpool, and the way their relationships were stretched and changed and contorted and transformed, but then later to some degree reconciled and what have you. So I that's why I really enjoy this film, and I enjoy the story of the Beatles generally, is because I find that, you know, I was in some bands, nothing like, you'll be shocked to learn, nothing as successful as the Beatles, but I was in some bands, and it's a really fun thing to do, but it can be a tough thing to do. Straying on friendships, and just something about this film speaks to me on that level.
Now, did you do you remember this movie? Like, were you there, like, when it came out, kind of thing? Were you looking forward to this?
I got, because this came out in 1994, and I think I got massively into the Beatles right after this came out. Sort of early to mid 1995 is when I discovered and then became obsessed with the Beatles. So I think It was on TV shortly after I got into them. I missed the theatrical release or what have you, but
okay,
it was right there when I was really getting into them. That would have been on Channel 4 or something one night, and recorded onto the VHS and what have you. So it was definitely part of my Beatles education. But I think going into it, I already knew a lot, so I probably knew more of the real story. So I was a bit immunized against some of the exaggerations. But I've got to say, not that bad. I don't think it plays too fast and loose with the truth. There are some cringeworthy moments that music biopics, even ones like this, for some reason they feel they have to do, like The Hard Day's Night, like The Old Days a Week. cheesy moments like that. Why would you make bother? Why?
Well, okay.
By and large, it's pretty accurate.
Don't bring that up, because I can't wait to hear what award this won. Well, Roy, let me ask you.
Yeah.
Do you remember this movie?
Yeah, because we were friends at this point, right? And I kind of remember this movie coming out. I didn't see it, but I remember this movie in the context of, like, we knew about it.
Yeah. Well, this movie, let me just, I'll just say, it was really, really big I think I was watching a lot of MTV at the time, and there must have been some kind of like commercial connection with this movie and MTV, because I think it was posted on our Facebook comments. I think Andy posted the MTV Movie Awards when the Backbeat Band played the Movie Awards, and they did three, not Beatles songs, but three songs that the Beatles covered, obviously.
Yeah.
And the band was packed with 90s superstars, like including Dave Grohl.
Yeah,
Dave Grohl was the drummer for, you know, the Beatles Backbeat Band, and then Mike Mills from REM was in it, and then, you know, a few other guys from, like, Sonic Youth and Soul Asylum and all that. And so I think I watched, like, I hadn't watched Backbeat until the last week or so, and I've always just kind of known about it and remembered it, but I feel like there was nothing in this movie that was new to me, because I remember there was this onslaught of, hey, did you know there was a fifth Beatle and his name was Stu, and that he died, and they were in Germany, and, you know, before they were big, all of this stuff happened, and, you know, he, like, fell in love with a German artist. So, like, the events of this movie, weirdly, were not new at all, like, the slightest, because of the promotional juggernaut that was Backbeat in 1994 on MTV. And so I think it's just – it's really weird that I haven't seen the movie until now, but – I weirdly felt like I had already seen it.
Huh.
That was just a weird 90s thing. And it was huge in 1994. We were all talking about it. It was on Entertainment Tonight. But I feel like this movie has disappeared since then.
Yeah. To the point.
Good reason to bring it back up.
To the point, Phil, where I had to watch it illegally. So.
Yeah, me too.
Okay.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah. So let me ask.
That's weird. I knew about Stu Sutcliffe and Pete Best even before I was a Beatles obsessive. That was just like something you got through your mother's milk in this country. By the time I could talk, I knew Pete Best and Stuart Sutcliffe existed, and they were lost Beatles.
So let me ask them, because this movie does put forth the idea that perhaps Stu and John were more than just best friends, right? And you have the dialogue where Stu and John are talking, and Stu basically says that Astrid asked the same question, and John said, "Well, what'd you tell her?" And what'd he say? That he just grunts, or he just laughed, or something. So, from your lifelong study of the Beatles, is that like an accepted thing? Is that accepted knowledge that John and Stu were more than friends?
I think it's certainly widely speculated that. That John may have been bisexual. I think some people do think John and Stu might have had a sexual relationship. I think that is not widely believed. John and Brian Epstein, the Beatles' latter manager, has been similarly argued. I think that it's more likely that they had a sexual relationship. Nobody knows. Nobody can be certain. But then even when he was with Yoko, John is on the record as saying that he liked her because she was like a bloke. So there's lots of little... One hates to say where there's smoke, there's fire, but there's lots of different situations in which those rumours have been made about John that makes me think
so
possibly it was true.
Yeah, so obviously, and the point being that, you know, we're not trying to, like, definitely not trying to say that can you believe John might have been bisexual, but the sadness that, like, he lived through a time where it would have been, like, something that he would have had to have hide, right? Or whatever.
Yeah. Well, like, last time I was with you, we had a bit of real talk about depression and mental health and things, and that was something I thought about when I was watching Backbeat was, you know, how different would things be if certain people in the past, in the music industry at least, had access to the slightly destigmatized attitude we have now towards A, different sexualities, and B, mental health generally.
Sure.
And also, you know, counseling and medication, because bisexual or not, John was an incredibly angry person who was incredibly emotionally damaged by all kinds of childhood traumas.
Yeah.
And if you can be glib and say, well, maybe that's that's what made him a musical genius, and that he poured his anguish into his art and blah, blah, blah. But also, who knows what how different things would have been if he might have had a bit of help and what have you. He might have had a happier life.
Can I ask, I don't know, this is naive of me to say, but is John Lennon the kind of person who cared at all about certain stigmas?
Good question. No. And certainly not in his later life. I think early 70s, he was...
And maybe that's what I'm thinking, you know, 70s John, who like went all the way through the 60s and just was like, whatever, I'm John Lennon, I can do whatever I want. I guess that's a difference. There's...
Well, exactly. And that is the one thing that gives me a bit of pause about sort of any unproven theories about John, is that in the early 70s, he was angry enough that he would have happily trashed any, reputation the Beatles had left. He was out there to tell the bare naked truth. And he never said anything about that. So maybe that wasn't a thing. I don't know.
Did you guys check out, before I forget, did you guys check out the, Astrid photographs and the Stu paintings?
Yeah.
Kind of good stuff.
I mean,
right?
Yeah.
My research went as far as going on to Google Images and typing in Stu Sutcliffe art and Astrid Kircher photographs. But, I mean, yeah, I checked some out.
I like the fact they really tried to recreate some of her photographs of the Beatles in that period.
Yeah, I think that was a really good moment when they recreated those. And also, I don't know, I think it's sad that Stu died. But I don't think he would be that miffed about missing out to the Beatles, because it seems like he would have had a really good, fun,
yes,
artistic, creatively fulfilled life.
I agree.
Had he lived. So, okay, let's talk respect, shall we?
Indeed.
Yes.
Okay, so we start off Detroit, 1952.
Can we start again by like, do any of you know anything about Aretha Franklin's life before? I didn't. John, did you know anything going in?
I would say I think I knew Aretha Franklin was really into gospel music for a reason I might mention later.
Okay.
That's all I knew. And I knew she had a great 80s hit song called Riding on the Freeway, which this movie skipped right past.
Okay.
So, yeah, Phil, what do you know about Aretha Franklin?
Almost literally nothing. Mm-hmm. We might talk a bit more about that afterwards, but yeah, that's why I'm kind of intrigued, is to my shame, I know about the titular song, and that's about it.
So I would posit that if you just went on to iTunes or whatever and just sampled some music from her greatest hits, you probably know half a dozen others.
Yeah,
quite possibly. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's what's her nickname? The queen of soul, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that kind of surprised me too. As I was like, oh, because I thought the same thing. I'm like, okay, well, she sings Respect, and I think there's one other song I know. But after the movies, then I was like, oh, there's probably about 8 songs that I'm familiar with, and I didn't know it was her.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's Aretha Franklin.
And we're done.
Okay. Let me take you guys back to Detroit. 1952, Aretha Franklin is playing piano. Forrest Whitaker's there. He's her dad. And she has a pretty good life. She sings gospel, and she sings extremely well. She's a little kid, and she sings at parties, and her dad trots her out and does some stuff.
So who's at the parties? Yes. Like, it's a serious who's who, right?
Yes.
Like, her parties are attended by Dinah Washington, Sam Cooke. Do they say Duke Ellington? Like, it's
Duke Ellington, I think. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah.
I think is just hanging out. So yeah, she's grown up. She is, she's the little girl that entertains, you know, some of the greatest people of the era. So, that's her deal. So, her dad, gets her a contract. Her dad, you know, and this is kind of the biopic aspect that you just kind of, it's like, wow, I guess every musician is like this, you know, where they're very young and their parent is extremely controlling to the point of like, why are you such an obnoxious parent? You know, what's up here? What's the deal here? she strikes a chord with Marlon Wayans.
Hey, so
who is a really great guy.
He's a great guy. John, you skipped like the most important detail of this entire film.
Okay, well, that's the weird thing. Okay, the weird thing about this movie, okay, the thing is this movie is very, very standard biopic type stuff. I'll just say that. But a weird thing that the movie does is it goes over everything and then it does a weird flashback where you go back and this thing that's like, oh, was she kind of taken advantage of at this party, you know? I don't know. It just kind of skimmed past that. But then it goes back later and it turns out, oh, not only was she taken advantage of, she had a child when she was like, I don't know, 7 years old or something. It's like extremely young because of this thing. And so the movie does a weird thing where it's like, okay, remember this thing that we just kind of implied happened? Well, that happened and this is the result. And remember how she had a drink in her hand at this time? Well, that happened a lot more than you think because like there was always the drink and that was like her demon that she had. Remember when they kind of had a fight on the way into the elevator, you know, with her husband? Well, let's go back to that just for a second and yeah, she gets punched on the elevator kind of thing. So I was going to save all that
for
the end because that's what this does.
I'm sorry.
But yeah, it confused Roy greatly. He also watched this movie. He knew I was skipping stuff. It's your right
so,
to
but,
correct me.
So,
but yeah.
But it's so like it's so she gets raped as like I don't know how old she's supposed to be, 10, 12, I don't know. But like
that's like really young.
So yeah. That's really early in the movie though, right? That part's not a flashback. She's just like party's happening, she's going to bed, some guy sneaks into the room, right? And you know exactly what happens because the next day she won't talk to anyone, right? But so, yeah, I mean, I think
well,
that
I don't
is
know
like
exactly what happens. That's what? I mean, isn't that the thing? You don't know exactly what happens. You don't know. I mean, you know she was traumatized probably in some kind of sexual way, but you don't know it's the necessarily the baby making sexual way.
That's true. That I mean that could be
you
true.
Know, yeah, because it's like it's a half hour later in the movie when it flashes back again and it shows her as a little girl with that giant baby bump and then
yeah.
You know. But when her career is going, like one thing they do, like the family, like the grandma takes care of her kids.
Yeah.
You know, while she gets everything going. But the thing is, Aretha, she does have this problem. She's a lot governed by her weird father, you know, Forrest Whitaker, and later, she meets this really great guy, Teddy. He's, like, really amazing. But, you know, this wouldn't be a behind-the-music kind of thing unless he gets really crazy eventually and he gets really controlling and he kind of takes on the same kind of things that her father, you know, had. And so pretty much Aretha, she has to let go of her dad. She has to let go of her husband. She has to let go of the alcohol. And pretty much, I'll just skip really close to the end, where she gets with Titus Andromedon from the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Nice.
And
he does a great job.
I'm changing all of my awards.
He's so good.
He does a really good job in this movie.
Okay, so and did you do what I did when you just like, oh my gosh, that's Titus Andromedon, and like stood up in the theater and pointed?
No, so I was, there were only two other people in the movie theater with me, by the way, but so I saw his name in the credits as the movie started. I'm like, oh my gosh, Titus Burgess is in this. And there's a part near the beginning where she's a kid and she's sitting down at a piano and she's playing with him, but he's got like a mustache or a beard. I'm like, is that him? Is that him? And then at the end, when he's clean shaven, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's Titus Andromedon, right? But, yeah. I mean, he does a great job.
Yeah. Oh, he's great. He's so talented. Well, you know, like, watching Kimmy Schmidt, you're like, man, this guy's good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's great. Especially when he sings that song about, like, mouth bones. He sings that song about teeth, and he calls...
Your outside bones.
Children. That's right. Your outside bones. Oh, my gosh. Anyway, the movie ends with her going back to church and doing her Amazing Grace album, which was her most famous album, and you know it was her gospel thing. So it's like, okay, she, you know, all of these things she couldn't depend on, but she was able to get respect in the end. And I think, you know, in her words, it's like, you know, when she found her way back to God, and you know, all of this stuff that she was able to like completely become herself, which explains in around the 2000 or so when I saw an episode of VH1's Divas when Shakira and Shania Twain and Aretha Franklin, they were all divas together, and they were all singing a medley together, except then Aretha Franklin like did this huge spiral of just impromptu gospel singing, and Shakira and Shania Twain had no idea what to do because, well, she's Aretha Franklin and she's the queen. She does what she wants, and so they just kind of had to like kind of awkwardly pretend to know what was going on when that happened.
So
that movie glossed over that.
It didn't do that. So, but it's fascinating because they set up, like, when she says, I'm doing this gospel album, and her producer's like, you're throwing your money away. No one buys this. No one's going to care. And then, of course, it's her highest selling album of all time, right? It's like her Folsom Prison Blues, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
although when I start buying Aretha Franklin albums, that's
not the first one.
That's not the first one.
So I looked into it. By the way, her version of Amazing Grace on that album is 16 minutes long.
So that is amazing.
That is. I don't know how you can do that, but
she found a way.
No, it's fascinating though because she starts this career based solely off her talent, but she's got no hits, right? And she doesn't get a hit until she can shed her father from her life, right? She has to break from her father, and then Teddy gives her a song, and she completely rearranges it, but then she's got a hit, right? And she works with the Muscle Shoals band, right? Bunch of pretty groovy guys.
I almost think they should have skipped the Muscle Shoals part, even though I think that's everybody's favorite part, because it's just for that little bit. I think Muscle Shoals is like one of those musical fans, like, okay, Muscle Shoals, that's a big deal, you know, so much good stuff came out of Muscle Shoals, and I feel like they couldn't fudge the facts too much because so little actually happened with Muscle Shoals, but it was so important in the overall history of music that I felt like they had to put it in.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not very good at deciding, you know, what to make up and what not to.
It's fascinating her progression, though. So she has her first big hit, and she's got some hits. But then, of course, the biggest hit that everyone's familiar with is Respect. And I don't know if they fudge with the timeline here, but she produces Respect basically around the same time that she finally... is this when she leaves Teddy for the first time or for the last time?
Let me look at my notes. Did you take notes in the theater?
I took no notes in the theater. So there's this progress, right? But can I tell you, like, there's all these performances, and Jennifer Hudson does a great job. But, John, the best performance in this movie is the end credits performance where you've got, like, 75-year-old Aretha Franklin playing for the Obamas. And she does Natural Woman, and it's just incredible.
Yeah. That was really good, you know, and that's kind of a funny thing. It's funny. We talk about like the tropes of biopics, and it's kind of a cliched thing to show like the actual person in the end credits. But also it's one of my favorite things about watching movies like this. Like, I look forward to it every time. It's like, ooh, they're going to do the thing. They're going to have the words at the end that say what happens. And also they're going to show like real footage of the actual person. And it's always fun to see that. Yeah.
So also, this movie's fascinating, and there's like lots of parts where like you can tell like what the air. So like when they're pushing her to do her European tour, and she's like, "No, I've got these other opportunities here in the States," and they say, "We will pay you $250,000. What do you think of that?" And it kind of feels like a Dr. Evil like asking for $1 million, right?
Or Lorne Michaels offering $5,000
to the Beatles,
Yes.
So this movie isn't very.
Yeah, that won't even pay off my house, $250,000.
So
that's weird how little money that is.
Yeah. So this movie's not very funny, and it seems like from the title that it's trying to be, but it's not. It's not a very funny movie. Phil. So if you're hoping to see a comedy, this isn't one. But there is lots of subtext of alcoholism and abuse, and so that's cool.
Yeah, it does this weird thing. Well, I told you the weird thing it does, where it, like, it plays things out, and then it kind of has a flashback of those same things, but then we're supposed to contextually just take what we saw earlier a little bit different. And I really appreciate that that was done. And it's kind of cool that they're kind of doing weird stuff like that with the flashbacks. But also at the same time, it kind of robs the rest of the movie of having that same context, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so I'm not quite sure what to think. Except for that one little trick that they do. Most of this is pretty, you know how I said, you know, standard biopic stuff that we kind of see and we kind of expect. Most of it, this is you know, is kind of the standard way to go,
yeah.
which is calming and comforting.
Yeah. By the way, her outfits are pretty incredible.
Good outfits.
She's got some great outfits.
Yeah, she's got some. The one in L.A., I watched this movie with Katie. We were in the theater. And in L.A. in 1970, and she's on a program called, I think, Angela Davis, and it's like on this TV program. And the 1970s dress that she wore with a really tight pattern, It was only on for like 5 seconds, but Katie was like, "Ooh, I want that dress." Yeah, but I didn't take enough notes to like write down exactly what the pattern was. I was like trying to sketch it really fast in the darkened theater. It was like impossible.
Oh. So, John, I'm curious. From some of the stuff you described, particularly early on, it sounded like it was kind of the anti-Buddy Holly story.
Oh,
and
yeah.
At the end, you said it was kind of comforting and calming.
Well, it's so like the last – this is a long movie, by the way. This is over 2.5 hours. And like at the two-hour mark, because I didn't realize it was that long, I was like, I mean, we've hit – like they're going to sum this up here real soon, right? But what I wasn't prepared for was the, oh, there's another half hour left of her being an alcoholic and falling off the stage.
The events weren't comforting.
The events are not comforting.
It's the way the movie is told.
Yeah.
Like it's like I'm used to seeing, you know, I've seen enough Behind the Musics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To kind of know the story a little bit. That's what I mean by comforting.
And I would say also the songs, right? Like they nail the songs.
Yeah.
And every time they play one of the songs, like, okay, well, you know, 2 minutes ago she was beat up by her husband in an elevator, but this song is really good, right?
Yeah,
yeah. So and that's the main thing.
Yeah, that's what's important. So,
have you guys seen Whiplash?
No.
John, did you say you watched Coal Miner's Daughter just for the heck of it?
No, hang on. I'm saying something else. I'll say one more thing before I forget. In the movie Whiplash, they talk about, and we talked a little bit about like John Lennon's trauma here, and Aretha Franklin went through all this trauma, and there's a lot of talk about, okay, an artist, you know, has to suffer to make something correct and good. I think one thing this movie does, and I think one thing that Whiplash does that we don't talk about too much, but you guys have to see the movie Whiplash, by the way, that it's not so much the trauma and the adversity that you face that makes the good music. It's actually moving past that makes the good music.
Yeah.
So, like, the idea that, okay, she had a terrible husband and she had a terrible father in so many ways – like, those things didn't make good music. It was only when she was able to shed those things and just remove those things that the good music came. And so, those things aren't necessarily necessary. I did not watch Coal Miner's Daughter. I got it from the library. I have the DVD. I might watch it later this week because I've always wanted to see Coal Miner's Daughter. But the movie I did watch was I Want to Hold Your Hand, which I found very delightful. It's got Wendy Jo Sperber in it. And a young Nancy Allen from RoboCop fame and Dressed to Kill. She's great. And two other girls, and it's four girls who are desperate to see the Ed Sullivan performance of the Beatles in New York. And it was pretty good. Phil, you haven't seen that, have you?
No, sounds good.
It's a good Beatles movie, although it's a very American Beatles movie. But unlike Backbeat, it has a lot of Beatles songs in it. Somehow they managed a lot of Beatles songs for this low-budget movie, 1978. I liked it.
Same year as Buddy Holly's story.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Mm. So much overlap. Same year as Buddy Holly.
Well,
and Paul McCartney owns the
Buddy Holly Library.
Right. Yeah.
Because Michael Jackson took Paul McCartney's music library.
So, yeah, he thought he'd get back at him through Buddy Holly, I guess.
Michael just sees for years about the Buddy Holly.
He knows that Michael Jackson's ghost really loves Buddy Holly.
All right. Well,
okay.
Want to do some awards?
Yep.
Yeah, I think it's time for awards. Sweet.
Dig out my bits of paper. I'm about three bits of paper here. There's so many.
All right. Yeah, I got it. Overboard with awards. Okay. Phil, best title?
I'm going to go with the Buddy Holly story just because it sets its simple and unambitious stall out early. That's what you've come for. That's what you're going to get.
Nice. Roymans, what do you have for best title?
So I love this because it was kind of... They could have used anything for the title, and I was shocked that they went with Respect for the Aretha Franklin movie title, because it's really original, and there's no way. So I don't know. I'm being sarcastic, right? Like, there was no way they could make that film without calling the movie Respect, right? Yeah. So, but I guess I'm going for that. The Buddy Holly story is that's like the description that should come after the title.
And like then, it should be called Oh Boy, colon, the Buddy Holly story.
The Buddy Holly story, yes. Yeah. Right. And then, so I don't know, Backbeat is, it's Backbeat, right? Whatever. So when I think of Backbeat, I just think of Phil Hartman. But anyway, Respect. I chose Respect.
I chose Backbeat. I'm surprised you guys didn't choose Backbeat. Because I kind of like thought, it's like, okay, this is like the background, but it's not the background, it's the backbeat. You know, this is behind the story is this. It's the Backbeat.
And also Beatles, I only realized like 5 minutes ago.
back Beatles, back, the story of back. Okay, yeah.
Back fat.
Yeah, tack back.
Tack back. Pone tack.
Back fat, pone tack.
Back pone.
Shack this is back. Good content.
Okay, Roy, best poster.
Yeah, I'm going with Respect. What a clean poster. It's a gorgeous poster.
Like George's grandfather. Yeah.
Yeah.
Phil, poster?
I went for Backbeat, the one that it's like their faces on a black background sort of fading away, if you saw that one. And I liked it because it looks like the Magnifico bit in the Bohemian Rhapsody video.
Oh, okay, sure. Okay,
and that made me think we should have been doing Bohemian Rhapsody in this podcast, but never mind.
Did you ever see Bohemian Rhapsody?
No, but I've heard it's either absolutely amazing or completely terrible, and I'm intrigued to find out which.
I found it very entertaining. Like, I don't think it was very well made, but it was also very entertaining to watch.
Okay.
It's interesting. Okay, again, I have to go with the Buddy Holly story, where it's like he looks like a comic book hero with weird electrical bolts coming out of him. Was he being electrocuted? Like, it's like, this is when we put Buddy Holly in the electric chair with a guitar and pulled the switch, and this is the movie that came out. Yeah.
It's like Buddy Holly, the reanimator. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, Phil, best opening credits.
I have gone with Respect because of such a low bar from the other two that I assume the one I hadn't seen would have to be better.
No one's going to pick Backbeat, right, for opening credits?
I did.
Okay, explain yourself, because those did sucked.
Do I remember it wrong?
Well,
I don't know.
They had like the you know, black and white photos of Liverpool, you know, it's back then. But like the music that was playing is like, you know, Ken Burns DVD menu music or something. It's like, where did this music come from? This is a Beatles movie. Movie. And this is how it opens up with the just
I'm sure you must be right. So
okay, I did Respect for the opening credits because I think because I'm like, okay, for this category, for this award, I'm including the movie trailers that I saw in the theater as part of the opening credits.
Okay.
Some of the movie trailers included the Venus and Serena movie and also a movie called The Eyes of Tammy Faye where Jessica Chastain plays Tammy Faye Baker. That looked really good. Did you see that one too? Okay.
Yeah.
And there was Dear Evan Hansen. Yeah, okay. And then House of Gucci looks amazing.
Yeah.
The Ridley Scott House of Gucci movie with Lady Gaga in it. That looks amazing. I'm going to see that. And then, of course, they did a James Bond trailer in front of Respect. So
those were your opening credits?
Those were my opening credits, yeah.
Okay.
Roy, best technology?
Overdubbing. Started in the Buddy Holly story.
Oh, yeah, where he taught him how to use a tape recorder in the
studio. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
That was good. Okay, Phil, best technology?
I was going to go with overdubbing as well, but in the end I went with gum-based dentistry.
Yeah. That's good. Of course, yeah. I went with the roller rink that's also a radio station? Phil, best food?
Buddy Holly's drumstick dinner. Looked delicious. Right at the start, he's having a chicken dinner with his folks when they're telling him he's playing the devil's music.
Oh, that's right. I was trying to remember, when did he eat his drummer's drumsticks? I don't remember. That's right. Yeah, there was it was a plate of 20 drumsticks, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
Man. So I knew there was
a dip,
food.
At least.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, so I went with corn that John Lennon ate. We didn't get to see him eat it, but he puked up corn. Okay. So at one point there was some good corn.
I went with honorable mention to the Romulan ale that the Beatles drink somewhere, because it was like just this blue ale, and they say, what do you call this? And they said Henry, which I think is a callback to what do they call Ringo's haircut? Arthur, maybe? But no, the winner is George's mother's scones.
Oh yeah, the scones, yeah.
Yeah. And I have to ask you this, Phil, how do you spell scone?
How do you spell it?
Yeah.
S-C-O-N-E.
Okay. And because we say scone here.
Oh well, that's a huge debate and argument, scone or scone.
So do you talk about it over there? Do some people say scone over there?
It's so controversial. There's two massive arguments attached to that culinary concept. One is, do you say scone or scone? And the other one is, everyone has jam and cream on scones or scones, but do you put jam on first and then cream, or cream on first and then jam, which is even more controversial than what you call it. No. So it's one innocent foodstuff that has two massive English controversies attached to it.
Okay, controversies again. Okay, that's popping up again. Are we talking like whipped cream?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't know if I've had whipped cream on a... And when we talk scones, because the scones we have here are the deep-fried things.
Yeah, it's probably different. But like you have biscuits, which you pour gravy on, and no one would pour gravy on a biscuit in this country.
Right, because so I think
scones might be the same, or a similar thing where it's not quite the same thing.
Is your scone like what we call an English muffin?
Possibly. That reminds me of German muffins in Parks and Rec. What the bleep is a German muffin?
I don't recall that.
But it's just really basic, you know, butter and flour and salt and a bit of sugar, and often like raisins and currants, like dried fruit.
Sure. I think that has okay. I'm gonna have jam on a scone later, so that'll be good. Roy, best name.
So this is an easy one. It's Ringo Starr.
Oh no, it's not. Didn't you pick Ringo Starr when we watched Hard Day's Night?
Probably it was the right choice then as well.
I don't know. I never took to the name Ringo Starr myself.
Okay.
Phil, what do you have for name?
Bruno Karschmeider.
I thought about Bruno Karschmeider. That's good. Honorable mention to Madman Mancuso.
Yeah.
But I actually went with Klaus Voormann.
That is a good name.
It's good.
Klaus is going to have his day. He's fine.
Okay, good.
He's a great guy.
Okay, Roy, best outfit.
Okay, Aretha has a dress that's all white, but it's got like these solid white bands that go around it. Mm. I don't know how to explain it adequately, but it's a gorgeous dress.
Okay, very good. Phil, outfit.
I guessed everything that Aretha Franklin wears, but failing that, Astrid's pink dress, I think was pretty good, that she's wearing when Stu dies, unfortunately, so she'll probably never wear it again.
The, like, Chinese dress thing?
Yeah, the sort of Asian thing. But basically anything that's not Stu's bohemian outfit, his sort of peck showing tied at the waist weird thing.
Okay, I went with Astrid's exposed neck, left shoulder sweater. Like, it was a sweater of seduction. Her sweater of seduction that exposed just that, the left side of her, like, down to the shoulder, the off-the-shoulder
sweater.
That's
a very discerning, precise pick.
Yeah, because she specifically targeted, like, her left side to kind of flash Stu. And also, right when I was writing it down, she was ripping it off herself. Like, oh my gosh! She totally removed that sweater. Just right as I was writing it down, is that I like
it. It was a lot more booby than I remembered, I have to say, Backbeat.
It was. We kind of skipped over that. I was amazed at how booby the movie was.
Yeah, I first watched it when I was like 15. I don't remember it being that booby. I think I was a bit young and innocent. I must have blacked it all out.
Yeah. I think they kind of got it. They're like, well, we can't get actual Beatles songs, so let's really play up the whole, you know, they're playing in a cabaret aspect of the movie. Mm. Okay, Phil, best alien?
George Harrison, who was an underage illegal immigrant.
Excellent.
In Germany.
Excellent work. Okay, Roy?
Well, I'm going with Klaus, but to be fair, no one who speaks German could be bad, so...
That's a good point.
Germans have never been the bad guys, as Andy Dwyer said.
I went with the cricket in the wall in the Buddy Holly story. They had to kind of, like, they searched high and low through the wall for
good
the crickets. Honorable mention to the crickets at the Apollo Theater for a few seconds there. When everyone stopped talking at the Apollo, the phone stopped ringing, everybody stopped scuffling about, just complete silence, yeah.
Everyone stopped typing on their typewriters.
Yeah, there was no more typing at the Apollo. Okay, Roy, best special effects.
Okay, Buddy's, I guess Buddy's gum teeth.
That's pretty good. Not a lot of visual effects in these three movies.
Nope.
No. I went for the cardboard door in the radio station that the Keystone Cops burst through.
Oh, wow. Okay. I went with, at the end of Backbeat after Stu died, Astrid is speaking to John Lennon. And just for a brief instant, it edits it so that she looks at John Lennon and she sees Stu for just a second, and then she sees John Lennon again. Phil, best location?
I've gone with the Kaiser Keller, which is the first club the Beatles play in, because having been in a band and played in some dives, that was very reminiscent. I could almost smell the smoke, cigarette smoke in my hair, and the sweat. Again, to use yet another Parks and Rec reference, it reminded me of Ron saying, this place smells like a wet mop. and I bet everyone in here is running a low-grade fever. So it really really summed up the seediness of dive bars.
Nice.
All right, but the best location is the cavern, to have been there, huh? So I was thinking about this as well. Like, there's probably someone who's still alive that was at the concert of the roller rink in the Buddy Holly story, right?
Yeah.
Like, that'd be a heck of a story to tell, but I'm going to go ahead and go with the cavern just as a bit of a Beatles fanboy, I guess.
The cavern club. The cavern club and the roller rink are better than mine. I think those are both better than mine, so those are kind of what I'm saying. But the one I wrote down is just Muscle Shoals, Alabama. It seems like the people are friendly there in Muscle Shoals. Okay. Roy, best song. This is a big one.
Okay, because the Beatles didn't really play much of their own music, right? And Aretha is great, but the best song, and they only practiced it, and they didn't play it all the way through, but Every Day by Buddy Holly.
Okay, yeah, Every Day wasn't very prominent, that's true. Yeah, that's really good. Okay, a lot of choices. Okay, Phil, what do you got?
I've always had a soft spot for Please Mr. Postman. Even if
the Beatles'
recorded version isn't the best version of it, but I still love that song. Also, Not Fade Away, I think, is really good. Twist and Shout, not a Beatles original, but great. And I'm just going to keep listening songs because there's so many. Oh Boy, I also liked. But I think Buddy Holly by Weezer, undoubtedly the best song.
Very good.
That's, yeah. Can't believe that they end, like, the Buddy Holly story ended, the credits, the closing credits ended with Buddy Holly, Weezer.
Buddy Holly by Weezer. So, did you read the trivia? Because they initially were going to throw American Pie into the ending credits.
Oh, I did read that. They were going to open the movie with American Pie and close the movie with American Pie, which, I mean, you know how I feel about that. I think that's a bad decision.
That would have been awful.
I think even people who like the song, like you, agree that it would have been not a good choice.
Yeah.
Okay. My song, I went with Oh Boy. I had a hard time deciding.
It's so good.
I just had to go Oh Boy. I just love the line, All My Kiss and You Don't Know What You've Been Missing. I mean, it's something I've always hummed to myself and sung to myself. It's a good song. Phil, best guest star?
Well, I can't believe this didn't come up when we were talking about it, but Laura Palmer.
Astrid, right?
Astrid. Oh, wow. I didn't realize until I watched it again. Yeah. I mean, I've seen Twin Peaks more than once. I'm a huge fan of Twin Peaks. And I've seen Backbeat a million times. And I only put two and two together when I was watching it again the other day.
That's right.
I think she's pretty good.
She's good. It's like, I feel almost like the people didn't use, let's see, what's her name, Sherilyn Fenn?
Cheryl Lee. Sherilyn Fenn was someone else in Twin Peaks.
Oh, really?
Oh, she was, I forget, but yeah, one of her friends.
Okay. Well, whoever she is, I feel like they didn't use her in too many movies because I think everybody just assumed she was dead because she was Laura Palmer. Like, oh, it's too bad Laura Palmer died.
I think she didn't do much acting generally. I think she hadn't acted before Twin Peaks. I don't think she did too much after that, I think. This is one of her very few acting roles, but I think she does it quite well.
Yeah, she's good. Yeah. I
don't know if either of you ever got into the TV show Psych, but they did a Twin Peaks homage that was just really good. Anyway,
I need to see.
Moving on.
Yeah. All right. Best guest star, Roy.
Mary J. Blige as Dinah Washington.
She was great. Yeah. She was really good. Yeah. That's good. I'll get to her in a minute. Okay, I went with Marc Maron. We did not mention Marc Maron at all, but he's Jerry
Wexler. Oh, seeing it.
Yeah, he plays the producer of, Aretha Franklin. He's, you know, the white guy is like, come on, just do it. I don't know. He just plays this whiny Jewish guy. And I'm especially picking Marc Maron because the night before I watched Respect, I saw Marc Maron perform comedy in Salt Lake because he came came to town. And wow. so he was like whiny and grumpy in a different way. He was kind of more he kind of had this vitality in his whininess in his stand up, and he kind of had more of a whiny aspect in the movie. So it was just kind of, it was fun. Yeah, I'm a fan.
He's so good in Glow. I mean, again, he's playing kind of the same character, playing himself, what have you, but he's so good in that. Extraordinary performance.
I like him. Okay, Roy, best external character.
This is really hard. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing you found something, John. I could not find an actor.
I didn't go with an actor.
Okay, so I went with motorboating, which Stu does a little motorboating, and then of course from the movie Red Shoes. We had some motorboating.
I can't believe you know about motorboating. Oh. Good Christian boy.
It's funny. I meant to look it up because I, like, in the back of my head, I'm like, I can't think of anybody in the back of my head. And since I kind of wrote something down as a joke, and so I didn't actually research the actors, I actually just went with the concept of A Hard Day's Night because John says, you know, we've had a hard day's night and day, or whatever. He says the thing, which is really annoying. But I wanted to bring up a bunch of things that they talk about in Backbeat, which I am considering recurring characters from, what's the movie we watched? A Hard Day's Night. It's called A Hard Day's Night. Sorry.
Yeah. I guess you could do that.
Yeah. At one point, when Stu is looking at the base he wants to buy, and he sees in the window, we don't know what he's talking about, and he says, I like the blonde, but I prefer the brunette. And then they show what he's looking at, and it's the two bases in the slightly different colors. And I think he says he's going to name it Arthur, which I think is a callback to Ringo Starr's haircut.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he calls his hair Arthur. And then John says, I call it a hard effing days and nights, which is what you really despise. You know, that's a callback to that movie. And they say, we've been playing 8 days a week. But probably the most maddening one is when John says, never mind the effing bollocks, which...
Does he?
He says that. He says that line, never mind the bollocks, which doesn't make any sense at all. I think they're just like, well, this... You know, he's just going to say this other famous album name that has nothing to do with the Beatles, so...
That hasn't come out for another decade and a half, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I'm just going to cut to it. I have a worse quote, and it's when John says, I call it a hard day's night, right? And because, like, what on earth are they thinking when they slip that in there? Because no one imagines that John, like, said that, right? Because, like, famously, like, Ringo said it dopily and during the filming of the movie, right? And then that's how it all happened. But anyway, they're stealing it from Ringo and putting it in John's mouth, and it's a lie.
You want to give Ringo less? That's up to you. Yeah. And Ringo, you know, when they asked him about the stealing, he just said in his John Lovett's voice, well, I'm just happy to be here, you know, so... let's see here. Where did we get to? Okay, Phil, do you have an external recurring character? This is the hardest one for our guests, so no worries if
you don't. It's the hardest one, and the only one I didn't come up with anything for, so I'll just fall back on my usual of the Dauphin.
Okay, that's fine. We didn't come up with one either. None of us came up with
none
one, really.
None of us did,
so
that's
perfect. Always great to hear you say the Dauphin. Okay. Roy, best internal recurring character.
Okay, so here's what I went with, right? So, Phil, you don't know this because you didn't watch Respect, but Aretha, her childhood name that her sisters continue to call her throughout her life is Ree, right? Like, her parents call her Ree, her sisters call her Ree. So in the song Respect, right, there's a background chorus where they recurrently say her name, and they say Ree, 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 Ree. So there's your recurring character.
I was going to bring this up in my unanswered questions. Is that something they made up for they made up the concept of them calling her Ree, as short for Aretha, and that's why they put it in the song? Or is, like, what I always assumed, it was just them saying the beginning of the word respect? Did they throw the whole her nickname is Ree into the movie so that the background singers can make it seem like they're saying her name rather than respect?
I don't know. I don't know, John. It seems like if they, like, decided to just we're gonna tell in this version that everyone called her Ree, that someone would come out and say, well, that's not true, right? Because people are still alive.
Yeah.
Some people.
All right, Phil, do you have an internal recurring character between the movies that you saw?
I do, and I'm very proud of myself that even though I didn't watch Respect, it involves that film, which is King Curtis, who plays sax on Respect song, I believe, according to Wikipedia, and is also the sax player whom Buddy Holly welcomes onto the stage when he plays at the Apollo.
Wow.
Things are going really well. He sort of waves them on from the wings and says, ladies and gentlemen, King Curtis! And he comes on and jams with them.
Oh, nice. Okay, yeah, no, I didn't notice that. But similarly, I went with Sam Cooke. Who was like, so not King Curtis, but Sam Cooke, who was a big musician at the time, but he overlaps, you know, I think he plays with Buddy Holly and he plays with Aretha Franklin, so he was in both movies. So, again, a lot of overlap.
It almost feels like there should be one from all three, given the time period and the respective influences, but there wasn't quite, I don't think, one from all three.
What do you have for best death?
Best death is the music
Oh,
that died.
The music.
It was the day the music died.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah,
because it's either that or Stew, basically, isn't it? And that's a bit depressing.
I went with Stew.
Well, you know, so he, I went. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, he like looked up at Astrid and said, "I'm sorry." That's his last words. I'm sorry because he died. That's a good death.
In real life, he died in the ambulance on the way to hospital.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go with Klaus's dignity, which dies multiple times.
I don't know, because I feel like Klaus, I feel like he was getting some, you know, it's like she spurned her lifelong lover, you know? Like, she and Astrid and Klaus were like lovers on the moors, like Catherine and Heathcliff, apparently, their whole lives. But I feel like even when Astrid was like completely committed to Stu, Klaus was inexplicably still hanging around. And I think getting some, and I think possibly was also having sex with Stu as well. I think it was only a benefit for Klaus.
Okay. So did you like when she cut Stu's hair to look just like Klaus?
I did like that.
Nothing weird there.
And he's like, oh, wow, okay, you... The Beatles, the trademark Beatles haircut is Astrid trying to make her current lover like her old lover. Yeah. Okay, best villain, Roy.
Stu Sutcliffe. If he hadn't died, he could have ruined the Beatles.
So isn't he a hero for dying?
Nope, we're going to get there, though.
Okay. Phil, best death, best villain.
Well, I've gone the opposite. I've gone with the toughs, the thugs in Liverpool who caused his lingering brain damage. But they're the heroes, according to Roy, because they assassinated Stu Sutcliffe.
I actually missed that. Did the movie imply that him getting beat up caused the brain hemorrhage later?
Yes, and who knows, but that is a real incident that happened that most people assume was the cause of it in the end.
Okay. I went with C.L. Franklin, Aretha Franklin's father, as the villain. I mean, a lot of fathers are protective of their daughters, but like when she brings over the man she's going to marry, a lot of fathers don't literally pull a gun. Like, where did that gun come from?
I know! The gun just comes right out of his pocket.
He's just always carrying a gun just in case Aretha Franklin brings home a man.
That's it's America.
Yeah, it's very on point there, yeah. And also, when he goes into Tate Donovan's recording studio, and he slaps Aretha Franklin in front of everybody and says, you know, "Don't you embarrass me, Aretha Franklin," and everyone's like, "What is this guy's deal?" I also think Tate Donovan was kind of a villain for not actually taking C.L. Franklin aside and saying to him, "Hey, look, I know she's your daughter, but this is my studio, and we don't have that kind of crap go on in here. You just kindly leave, sir." Like, because that's what should have happened. Mm. Okay. Best hero, Roy, I can't wait to hear.
The aneurysm.
Okay. All right, Phil. Bring us home.
Well, I went for either George Harrison for just being chill throughout, because he's just a relaxed guy. Or I'm going to say Klaus for being classy, for not being toxic, for just accepting. Yeah. And then, you know, like we said, he did the illustration on Revolver, and he played bass on Imagine, and he played bass on lots of Ringo's records and George's records and the concert for Bangladesh. And he stayed close to them because he was just a classy, chill guy.
Yeah. That is really weird. The bass is just such a weird thing in these movies. I guess not so much Aretha or in Respect, but you know, the fact that the guy from Never Cry Wolf had that big giant upright bass the whole time in the Buddy Holly story, and you know, it was like, who's on bass? Who's on first bass? Is it Paul or is it Stu? And they talk about, isn't it funny how they talk about how Paul is a much better bass player? Like, who wants to be the bass player? I feel like, you know, but it is kind of weird. I don't know how it would have lasted with three guitarists in the Beatles. I don't know why the Beatles ever would have needed three guitarists. So it makes sense that they're, you know, the Fab Four. But also, and you guys didn't see this, but there's a moment in I Want to Hold Your Hand where Nancy Ellen finds herself in the Beatles hotel room and Paul's bass is sitting there and she licks the bass. So anyway, that's a thing that happened in that other movie.
Pre-COVID.
Fun fact, friends. So the in Chinese, the beetles are called pitose, because it sounds like beetles, but it also means messy-haired four. Isn't that clever?
Pitose means messy-haired four.
Yep.
That's pitose. Cool. That's funny. Yeah. Okay, my hero is Buddy Holly.
Oh, very good.
I think, you know, he's just straightforward. It's just he has the brains and the willingness to get it done, so good for him. Okay, Roy, best goof.
Okay, there's a train at the Hamburg station that has a service date of February 22nd, 1990.
Wow. That's so it's like a Hogwarts time-traveling train.
I guess, yeah.
Okay, Phil, do you have a goof?
This drove me crazy. Throughout the Buddy Holly story, he's shown playing a Fender Telecaster. And from what I can see, Buddy Holly played exclusively Stratocasters. And in every other way, you know, they try to be really accurate, and Gary Busey throws himself into the role, and he's just playing consistently throughout the whole film the wrong guitar, and I just don't know why.
That's weird. And he's literally playing the wrong guitar. They got actually playing it, but it's wrong.
Exactly. He goes all the effort to play the songs live and accurately, and in every other respect, he throws himself into the role. Yeah. And I can't work out why they've just got him playing the wrong guitar in every single scene. Except on the poster, the film poster for Buddy Holly's story, with Gary Busey on it as Buddy Holly, he's holding a Stratocaster that he doesn't play in the film, but on the poster he gets it right. That's weird.
First of all, I think I read somewhere that there are actually four crickets, not three crickets. So I think they removed a guy.
Mm-hmm. I need to give some context here because it's going to come up later. Mm-hmm. They didn't use their right names for the other two crickets because their names, the rights to their names were to another movie in development.
Yeah.
So they had to change the names of his bandmates for this movie.
Yeah, that's so funny. It's just a weird show business thing. It's like, okay, this is the only Buddy Holly story movie made this year, but since this other movie that will never come out and never exist owns the names, we have to fudge this one element. That's just a weird thing.
Yeah.
It's like in 30 Rock, a Jackie Jorp situation. in the movie Respect, though, there's also a part where the music stops. They stop playing music, and off cue, the two girls in the front row turn to look at the, you know, turn to stop dancing 3 seconds before the music stops. Like, they were quick on their cue. Yeah. So, Phil, what's your favorite LOL funny moment?
It's the Keystone Cops bursting into the radio station.
Yes.
Because it's so not funny that it's funny.
No, that's really good. I actually, the whole, yeah, I kind of have written down the whole, like, why did a DJ barricade himself in, like, doing this, like,
Eastern Month protest.
Like, I have to play Buddy Holly all the time. Okay. Roy, funny?
Yeah, it's a Klaus moment when Klaus says, "You're wearing my robe." And I know it's not supposed to be funny, but I laughed pretty hard. Poor Klaus.
Honorable mention seeing Titus Andromedon just in the movie of Respect. but I actually went with John's failed stand-up routine when he goes to the, I think it's at the Cavern Club at the very beginning, when he says, you know, something like, "Oh, well, at least we keep our clothes on." And then no one laughs. And then he says, you know, "I was going to be named after my father, but what kind of name is Dad?"
Yeah.
And no one laughs
and
again.
And he has that really bad Scottish accent. Yeah, it really sells it.
He does what he can. Okay. Phil, what do you have for the WTH, what WTF moment? I should say WTF because Mark Maron's in it. Yeah.
Why would Stu Sutcliffe trade wonderful salt of the earth working class Great British Liverpool for pretentious bohemian Hamburg wankers who spout War and Peace in Russian by heart while wearing period costumes and doing limbo dancing? Insufferable.
The memorizing War and Peace, gosh, I mean, you gotta respect the effort, but also, come on, man. Can't you do something else? Like, do a painting in that time or something. Okay, yeah, that's pretty good. Roy, you're WTH.
Sure. So in Respect, right, like it starts out so cheerful, and she's this effervescent girl, and she loves to sing, and one night she doesn't get to sing, and so the guy comes to her door and asks if she has a boyfriend, and she just giggles and says no, and he says, I could be your boyfriend, and closes the door behind him. And I was not prepared for that moment.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's nuts.
Yeah.
My moment was at the end of Buddy Holly when they just kind of casually mentioned the plane crash in the end notes of the movie. So, that's fine. I guess we all knew, but, you know. Okay, Roy, best scene.
Okay, so I'm going to go when Aretha finally leaves Ted in Respect. When he's, like, abusing her in the hotel room and she pushes back and she leaves and it's for good. And it kind of bleeds over into her next concert where it shows him in the back of the room and he leaves. And that's the end of Ted.
Hmm. Very nice. Okay. Phil, best scene?
Buddy Holly and the Crickets at the Apollo, because it just kind of sums up that film in the sense that there's like a tiny bit of tension where, ooh, they're not what they expected, but then within 5 seconds they've won the audience over, and then they get the saxophone guys out from the wings to join in jam, and then everyone's up in the aisles dancing, and that's just that film in a nutshell, because hey, everything's great and they were wonderful and everyone loved them and everyone's happy, and isn't that great?
I do, yeah, it's always fun to see a combination, you know, of it's like, okay, you know what, this group and this group are going to come together and dance. We're going to dance. Okay. I really like the roller rink scene, but also I really like the Madman Mancuso barricade. I think I might put that as my best scene.
Okay.
It's just the DJ barricaded in. Yeah. Okay. Roy, best actor.
Oh, this is tough. My honorable mention is Titus Burgess. I think he does really good. And then I want to put Jennifer Hudson as Aretha Franklin. I think she does a great job. But I just think it's impossible to not choose Gary Busey as Buddy Holly.
Okay. I put Jennifer Hudson as my honorable mention. I think Jennifer Hudson, I think she's just so good. Like, I'm not, like, a fan. Yeah. Like, I don't own Jennifer Hudson records. But I remember when she came in, like, seventh place at American Idol. And then after that, she went on to just be really just a magnificent performer after that, and just, you know, a great artist. And I think Jennifer Hudson, she was the one meant to play Aretha Franklin, so I think she's good. But before I say my actual winner, Phil, what do you have?
A bit like Roy, I thought the John, Paul, and George were all really well cast. Mm-hmm. I'm sure other people would disagree, but I think they largely avoid the trap of just doing an impression of the person they're playing, mm-hmm. the really well-known person that they're playing, but have enough of that in them that it's recognizable, and they've, you know, assimilated their subtleties really nicely. But then you can't look past Gary Busey. It's just a great eye-catching performance. But then that was before I knew that Titus Burgess was in Respect, so I'll say Titus Burgess.
Okay, nice. I didn't go with Gary Busey. I went with the other Gary, Gary Bakewell, playing Paul McCartney. And is it good acting to look exactly like Paul McCartney? I say yes, it is.
he played him again, didn't he, in something I've never seen called The Linda McCartney Story a few years later.
Oh, really?
He's made a little bit of a career of playing him. But yeah, he does look uncannily like him. And just, like I said, doesn't do an impression of him exactly.
Right.
But gets enough of it. I thought they were very well cast, all of them.
Yeah. He was all right. And he wasn't... He didn't do the... It's funny, because I mentioned Dana Carvey. Dana Carvey does this Paul McCartney impression that is, like, kind of an offensive Paul McCartney impression, you know? It's just, like, really, really goofy and weird and over the top. And I think when people impersonate Paul McCartney, they do Dana Carvey impersonating.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, no, he's just a normal guy. And it's like, oh, wow, Paul McCartney, maybe he was cool. Maybe he's not the silly guy that Dana Carvey always, you know, performs. So, okay. Okay, questions. Any questions? Okay, Roy, any questions that you have to ask?
Sure. So, was Richie Valens the best Maraca player of his generation? Because we see him at the very end. We see him at the very end of the Buddy Holly
story.
End,
he's playing maracas. The maracas.
Yep. All we get is maracas.
I like to think that he, because he was the guitarist in his own band, and he had his own maraca player that was probably better. So, no. I say no.
Okay.
Okay, Phil, do you have a question?
Just a sort of vaguely serious and vaguely plaintive, sad question, which is, you know, what would Buddy Holly be doing now? Well, I guess he'd probably be dead now, but if he'd lived, what kind of music would he have made? I think it's always fascinating, you know, whether it's Kurt Cobain or John Lennon or Buddy Holly, all these people who've died young, Jimi Hendrix, what would they have created had they survived? Is their legend stronger because they died young, or would they have done...
Go ahead, sorry.
No, you go.
I'm guessing he would have pulled a Pat Boone and he would have done a metal cover album.
Oh, I hope so.
80-year-old Buddy Holly singing Rainbow in the Dark by Dio.
Right, so. I mean, that's I guess that's the good thing about dying, because you can't... I mean, I can attest to this as an old person. You just can't be cool when you're old. You just can't.
Man, can you imagine if, like, Depeche Mode had died tragically in a plane crash after Songs of Faith and Devotion? We'd just all be so happy. Is it awful to say that?
Think
how content we would be with their brilliant career, right?
Everybody we know would, like, be huge fans, and they'd wear the shirts, and they'd, like, you know the songs, and they'd talk about, you know... this album, and it would just be like established that they'd be good. But
Roy, I've always thought of you as like a nice guy at heart, but so far you've cheered on a brain tumor for killing Stuart Sutcliffe, and you wish that Depeche Mode had died in a plane crash.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping the Facebook police aren't listening to this podcast. I'll probably.
He's like Thanos. He's like in love with death. Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. Oh boy, it's my favorite.
It's good. Okay, my question though is, are there really no drums allowed in the Grand Ole Opry?
Oh, which movie was that? Was that the Buddy Holly story?
In Buddy Holly, like when they're record that disastrous recording in Nashville with the terrible producer who wants to slow it down. He says, you know, they're like, we don't even have drums on this. And he says, drums aren't allowed in the Grand Ole Opry, so they're not allowed here, or something like that.
Yes, to this day, you can't play drums in the Grand Ole Opry. And since it's in Tennessee, no one's going to say anything if they want to shoot you. So.
Yeah. Okay, I'll assume you looked that up just now.
Yeah, definitely.
I believe you. All right, let's do lines. Let's do lines of dialogue.
Okay,
Roy, what do you have for best line?
Okay, my favorite quote?
Yes.
Okay, this is such a weird quote, and I just kind of love it, and it was like, what it is to say? But at the roller rink, right, when Buddy Holly decides to play not stupid music, he says, we'd like to do this one for the boppers, for those of you who bop, because he had to explain it, right? Oh, that's my favorite line.
Favorite line, weird favorite line. Okay, Phil, line?
Again, it's kind of just serious and sad. It's, there goes Stu Sutcliffe. He could have been in the Beatles, but he never really learned to play. Because I think that applies to me in my life. I think people could say that about everything I've ever done. There goes Phil Burkitt. He could have been something, but he just wasn't very good at it.
Well, there's kind of a double meaning, right? It's like, he didn't learn to play the bass, but also he didn't learn to play the game of music. So... that's interesting. But I remember that line very well. I never saw Backbeat until just barely, but I remember the line. There he goes, Stu Sutcliffe. He could have been in the Beatles. Yeah. I used to quote that all the time. Okay. But my line is actually from the movie Respect, and that's when Aretha Franklin plays in a club and Dinah Washington is in the club and she plays a Dinah Washington song and Dinah Washington throws the table over and yells at Aretha Franklin, bitch, don't you sing Queen songs when the Queen is in front of you. So, yeah, Mary J. Blige is Dinah Washington. It was a great, great moment.
It's really good.
Okay, now, best tagline, Phil.
I need to go back a bit.
Tagline, existing taglines.
Oh, they were terrible, mostly. So I've gone with "The Queen Arrives" on the subject of the Queen, from Respect.
From Respect.
The others were awful.
Okay. Yeah, Roy, I hope you picked the 5-4-3-2-1 of Backbeat.
I chose Find Out What It Means. That's the one I saw.
Oh, dang it. Okay. I also did Find Out What It Means, because I think that's like the ultimate tagline. It's like to get you into a movie. It's like, oh, I'll learn the meaning of a word in this movie. It's telling the tagline is telling me that this is what I'll learn in the movie. So
that's right.
That's good. Okay. Okay, let's do our personal taglines. Roy,
sure.
What do you have for re-taglines?
Okay, for the Buddy Holly story, meet Buddy Holly and his two best friends, copyright protected and copyright protected.
It's kind of like mine. Okay, keep going. Nice.
Okay, from Backbeat, some aneurysms are for the best. Okay, moving on. From Respect, maybe you've heard this one, and this one, and this one, and this one, and this one.
Good, good. Okay, Phil, yeah. Do you have taglines?
From Backbeat, I took a leaf out of John Lennon's book and just said, "It's all dick."
He said that so many times.
He did.
Oh my gosh.
That's so true. It is all dick when you think about it.
Yeah.
For Buddy Holly, I went with American Dream, British Teeth.
Perfect. Oh, man.
That's good. That's very good. Okay.
And Respect, because I hadn't seen it and I didn't know anything about Aretha Franklin, I had to take a wild guess, and I went for .. And these are only the victims we know about.
Oh, that's very good.
Was I close?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No, very
she murders like
yeah.
seven people, at yeah. least allegedly.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah, allegedly. Perfect. Okay, for mine, for Buddy Holly, I have... You might not know his name, which is really Charles Hardin Holly, but you know his music. Okay, for Backbeat, I have, before they were the Fab Four, they were the Fornicating Five. For Respect, I have Aretha gets the Respect.
Oh, look at you. Very good.
Yeah.
Nice.
Okay, now let's go to titular moments. Phil, you only need two titular moments, or one, whatever, I don't know, we haven't decided this. We should probably just do one titular moment for our award.
So I've got one for each movie.
Roy, you go first.
Sure, from the Buddy Holly story, I've got, hey, what is the name of the airplane we have to get on this cold wintry night? Well, Buddy, oddly enough, it's called the Buddy Holly story. Weird. Yeah, let's go.
That's, yeah. That was a weird, kind of said under their breath there.
It's weird that they said that, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, go to the other ones.
For Backbeat, I've got, I'm going to backbeat your face with a brick. That's probably what the thugs said in the alleyway.
Backbeat your face with
a brick. But then Respect, I mean, she says Respect about 3 billion times, but we'll just go with R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me.
Okay, that's good. Good use of Respect. Okay, I went with, in the Buddy Holly story, when Madman Mancuso was barricading himself in, he was playing all like the 15 hours of Buddy Holly right in a row, and at one point he yells to the cops before they gunned him down, "This isn't about me. Kill me if you want. This is the Buddy Holly story." Yeah. And then in Backbeat, it's when they sing the song Rock and Roll, which is, it's got a backbeat, you can use it. So
nice.
And then in Respect, I like the part where they went re 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 re, a little respect. Yeah, that part.
Yeah.
That's the best part. Okay, Phil, I think we kind of took all the uses of the titular uses, but if you have any more, go ahead with them.
I do not. I had missed this category, and I'm not going to debase myself by flanneling and trying to come up with something half-assed to the last minute, especially as I can't improve on yours.
It's an evolving new category, and I don't know. Roy, I'm thinking we might have to just eliminate, like, we should just have one use instead of three uses for next time. I don't know.
Okay, just our favorite from any of the three?
Just our favorite, which is probably the one that we make up.
Yeah.
Okay. Best Odyssey reference, Roy.
Well, Astrid is Circe.
Oh, okay, Astrid is Circe. That's good. Okay.
Sure.
Phil, do you have an Odyssey reference?
I don't. Sorry, I've let you down again.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Have. Odysseus loses all his crewmates. I think, you know, like when he lands on, like when he crashes on Calypso's place. I think, you know, he loses all his crewmates, which is kind of like Buddy Holly when he lost all his bandmates. Okay. All right, special awards, I think. Best performance. So this is like single song performance, I think?
Yes.
Okay, Phil, what do you have for best performance?
I think it's hard to say because they made such a great commitment in Buddy Holly's story to doing everything live. But I think the performance of Twist and Shout in Backbeat is so reminiscent of the actual Beatles recording of Twist and Shout that I have to go for that, because that's just such a, I know it's not their song, but it's an amazing performance of their song on the album, and I think the version on the film comes close enough to it that it just sparks that old Beatles flame within me.
Very good for how many times it's removed, because you have the original version, then you have the covered by the Beatles, and then you have the Backbeat band performing it, and then you have the actors interpreting the Backbeat band. So lots of copies of copies. Nevertheless, I agree with you. I mean, it's great. So besides all that,
so if we're talking like where, if I could only be at one of these performances in the history of music, right, then it would be Twist and Shout, right? But I think the best performance, I'm going to go with Oh Boy at the Apollo, but caveating that only because I don't consider Aretha Franklin in the end credits performing her song counts, because she's not Jennifer Hudson, the actress. But that was a pretty incredible performance at the end of that film.
Yeah, that was really good. There were a lot of, it's funny, there were a lot of great performances, and Jennifer Hudson, I think they did something similar with her, like, I think I heard, like, on Marin's podcast, because he talked about a bunch of people that made the movie. I think they kind of mentioned that Jennifer Hudson actually did live singing during the takes, and in then the Buddy Holly story, those were live takes, which I kind of had a hard time believing, because there were so many cuts, and they'd have to base the cuts around the one single performance, and they'd have to edit around that. I don't know. I'd have to see how it worked. But I preferred the Backbeat performances. Sad to say, I know. I think it's kind of silly, because I don't know if Backbeat isn't the most well-aged movie, but I think the version of Please Mr. Postman, I think, was the one I liked the most. I think there was a lot of George and Paul harmonies on that, too, that were really cool. So, okay, Battle of the Bands. Who has the best... What's the best band? Well, I'll just say the Beatles. Okay, Roy, what do you say?
So I'm basing it off the bands I see in this film.
Okay.
In the film, right? So I'm not calling it like the Beatles as in the Beatles and their entire career. This is the Beatles in this film, where I don't see them perform a single song that they've written, right? So based on that era Beatles and Aretha Franklin... But I think I'm going with Buddy Holly. I think like a Buddy Holly show would just rock. It would just be just awesome.
Yeah, there might be actually better music at the Buddy Holly show than the Beatles show.
Yep.
I think there's something about, I don't know. I mostly hated the 90s. But there's something about the Backbeat band with all the grunge artists. Where they assembled together and they had all these people, who reinterpreted the songs of the Beatles, and there's something very 90s and kind of nostalgic for me in the 90s with these old 60s Beatles cover songs that I think was captured in a kind of weird way with Backbeat. So I think that's one thing. Okay, Phil, Battle of the Bands.
Yeah, I mean, unsurprisingly, I'm going to go with the Beatles. Buddy Holly band looks really good in the film. I looked at a few videos of them from real life, and they weren't half as cool. But they were still pretty cool. But weirdly, kind of the opposite is true with the Beatles here, is in that they keep making the point in the film that Stu's meant to be a really bad bass player. But because they really want their soundtrack to be kick-ass and really good, he's actually really great, apart from like one time where they make a point of him being noticeably bad. Yeah. But apart from that, he's actually really proficient and way more proficient than he was in real life.
Right, and I kind of thought that was kind of weird because he seemed like he was really good. Like, it seemed like he was like... He was so good that he was just kind of, you know, it was second nature to him. That's kind of what it looked like. I don't think it was supposed to look like that, but it seemed like he was just, like, having the easiest time doing it. But, yeah, whatever.
But who are we kidding? The Beatles. I mean, like, I do think the Buddy Holly story did a really good job of making me think, you know, like in the Apollo, you know, if I saw this and I wasn't used to this, I would have thought, wow, this is amazing and new and exciting. But the same can be said of the Beatles and... Mm. You know, you can't beat the Beatles.
No. Fair enough. Okay, now, what, accuracy-wise, Phil, what would you say is the realest movie?
I'm actually, because I've only seen the two, but of the two I've seen, I'm going to say Backbeat, because I did appreciate the attention to detail. Mm-hmm. Like, some of the, and like I said, I'm a slightly lapsed Beatles expert, and like, it's not perfect in terms of its timeline, and it takes a couple of liberties, but nothing too bad. And it really makes an effort with a lot of the costumes, a lot of the instruments are very accurate. It recreates a lot of the photo shoots really accurately. So I think it knew what it was doing, and it took liberties here and there, but it did enough to. Paid enough attention to detail in little bits where they didn't need to pay attention to detail if they didn't want to kind of let you know that, yes, we are treating this with some degree of reverence, and even though we've slightly messed with the timeline here and there, I think it was done by people who knew the facts reasonably well and wanted to tell a faithful story that was still an interesting movie narrative.
Excellent. Okay, Roy, realist?
It should be Backbeat, but then John says, "It's been a hard day's night," and that's where I almost knocked my TV off the wall.
I'm out.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm like, oh, okay. So I chose Respect, and I didn't dig too deep. I know that the Buddy Holly story took some liberties, so I'm assuming Respect.
I think I chose Respect, and I think the fact that it was made in 2021, it like almost has to be the realist. Accuracy wise, because I think we police that kind of thing these days a lot more than you know, in the past. So, and also we'll get to another reason why in a minute. But I picked Respect as well for realist accuracy. Okay, now Roy, the realist attitude though.
So first thing first, who's the realist? I'm going to go with Stuart Sutcliffe. He knew what he was. He knew what he wanted. He had the Beatles. Could have been the Beatles, right? But he stuck with what he wanted. So Stuart Sutcliffe is the realist.
Okay. Okay. Phil, who would you say is the realist?
Buddy Holly. Man with a vision, didn't compromise, created a new strand of popular music. I admire him.
Right. I have Buddy Holly as well. Okay, do we have like realist person and realist movie, or do we just have realist person?
I thought we did realist movie already.
Right.
And then we just did realist person.
Well, we had realist as far as accuracy goes.
Oh, what movie's got the most attitude?
And then which movie has the most attitude? Well, that's what I put Buddy Holly movie has the realist attitude, but I didn't write down a realist character, so that's why I said Buddy Holly. Because I didn't have a realist character. But I'll just say Buddy Holly again for realist character.
Well, very good.
All right. No, that's fine. Okay, we're done being real. We're done being real. Okay, Roy. Okay, this is the last one.
Yeah.
Most educational. Which movie did I went you with the most?
I went with Respect. I didn't know anything about Aretha Franklin.
Me too. It's not based on the ability of the movie to teach me, but how little I knew about the life of Aretha Franklin.
Very good.
So, yeah, Respect is the most educational movie. Phil, you have two choices. Which one did you learn the most?
Yeah, well, Backbeat, I went into it from the opposite perspective of me judging it for its accuracy rather than learning anything from it, because I'm a pompous Beatles obsessive. So I would have to say Buddy Holly story, which I did learn a lot from. Most of it probably not true, but I did learn a lot.
Yep. Okay. That's right. That's the right answer.
Very good.
Okay. I think that's it. Okay.
All right.
Time for rankings. Roy, number three.
Sorry, Phil. Sorry, Stu. I'm going to go with Backbeat.
Backbeat, you're number three.
Okay. Yep.
That's fine. Phil, what do you have?
Number three, I'm going to go for Respect. Sorry, guys, but I don't believe we should be venerating a serial killer.
Excellent point. Excellent point. I see why you boycotted this movie. I'm actually also going to go Respect. It was really good. I learned a lot, and they did some nice biopic tricks. But it's my number three, actually. But I did enjoy it. Okay, my number two, I am going to go with Backbeat, a movie I also liked. Okay, Phil, what do you have for number two?
Yeah, I'm going to change my mind at the last second here, and I'm going to say Backbeat as well. I enjoy it. I enjoy almost everything to do with the Beatles. I think it's the kind of film people can knock. You know, I think really obsessive Beatle fans will complain about tiny inaccuracies, and you can poke some holes in it in other places. You can say it's a bit melodramatic, a bit overwrought, but I like it.
Okay, Roy, I think I know your answer for number two. Go ahead, though.
It's Respect. Yep. So we are all in agreement.
Yeah. Buddy Holly story, I think we all found really, really great. And I think it's really, really great. I still have a hard time explaining why it was so much more – it was the most enjoyable one. Like, I have a hard time explaining.
Very true.
Yeah. It just seemed like I learned a lot about Buddy Holly, but it also seemed just unweighed down by the conventions of biopics where, you know, we have to see certain things or whatever.
Yeah.
But, it was straightforward, but straightforward in the best way. So
it was, it was delightful. It was just so fun to watch.
That's the word for it, delightful. It was fun. I could tell you 100 things that were wrong with it, but...
Yeah.
And not many that were right with it, but I still liked it the most out of all these. I think... Perhaps I was just expecting, you know, I thought, oh, I don't really know Buddy Holly very well. I'm not really interested in Buddy Holly, some famous songs, but whatever. So perhaps because I went in with low expectations, and then what I got was just, it wasn't plodding. It wasn't trying to preach to you about this person. It wasn't sort of mainly retentive about detail. It was just a kind of shiny, happy, clappy American dream story about this great guy and his success. And then they cut it off before he died, just to keep the good vibes going.
Yeah. God wanted to hear Buddy Holly music, so
yeah.
Okay.
I
think that's a good podcast. I think it was good. I think it had a good beat. We danced to it, and it totally happened. So let's. We're gonna
future
do something.
Business?
We're doing future business. We're gonna do Nightmare. Future business right now, because who knows how this is going to turn out to you listeners. But what we got next in the next podcast, we're speaking with the Cortese brothers, and they have their movie picks, and we're about to get them on the phone right now. We didn't really call them before and have this weird conversation through the speakerphone of my phone because we had Skype problems. But we're going to just go ahead and actually call them over the phone right now. So we'll see how that turns out on the recording. If it doesn't turn out, then we'll just tell you what the movies are later. But okay, they're on the phone. Let's get them on the phone. Hey, is this Sean?
This is.
Okay. Hey, this is John from the podcast. I'm just calling you on my normal phone. Okay, and I'm holding you up to my microphone that I'm on Spike with you on. Spike on Skype with the other guys. Okay.
Okay.
Is Anthony or do you go by Tony there?
Yeah, he's here. Yo, I'm here.
Okay. I'm trying to figure out.
I actually go by Tony.
You go by Tony. Okay. Is it Cortese? Is that how you say your last name?
Cortese.
Okay. I saw it spelled, and I was like, I saw that, and I was like, oh, isn't that Dan Cortez from MTV Sports? Isn't that his name? And so, like, yeah, when I was predicting, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but, you know, on our Facebook page, it's like, hey, what movies are Tony and Sean going to pick? I picked three Dan Cortez movies, and I don't know if anybody got that, but... Okay.
Appreciate and honoring the namesakes, at least we should, we may need to dive deep into his work and find out exactly, you know, if our heritage lined up, or who knows.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably something we can do, you know, on a future podcast with you guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wasn't Dan Cortese in an episode of Seinfeld?
He was in Seinfeld. He was the guy with the beautiful face. Yeah.
Yeah, he played Tony.
Wow.
Yeah. 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 Okay, I'm dying. You guys are going to come on in 2 weeks. You're going to be together. And, you know, you're a referral from Josh, Roy's brother and my, you know, nemesis sometimes.
Absolutely.
But I'm really curious. Go ahead. Tell me your first movie that you wanna join the podcast with.
So the first movie that we're going to be joining with will be the 1987 classic Predator.
Oh my!
Oh. Oh my gosh! I'm so excited.
Okay, of course.
How have you guys not done Predator?
We haven't done Predator.
I don't know.
Yet. Yeah, no, that's crazy. Okay, that's
I feel
that's
cheated.
Beautiful. Okay, an American classic. That's beautiful. I can't wait to watch it. Shane Black is in it. You got the Carl Weathers. Okay, well, we all know Predator, but okay, I'm gonna save myself for when we actually talk. That's an excellent pick. Okay, what's your second pick?
Our second pick will be staying in the same lane a little bit, but we will be doing Aliens.
Okay, Bill Paxton. Aliens. That's
so
pretty good.
The beautiful Sigourney Weaver.
Yes. Yes.
Put your clothes back on, Ripley.
Yeah. We got Sigourney Weaver and Michael Biehn. Oh my gosh! I just heard another podcast about Aliens. It got me so excited to watch Aliens. I haven't seen Aliens actually in a really, really long time.
Yeah, it's been decades.
Wow. Yeah,
if I jump ship on this podcast now, can I come back and do theirs instead?
Oh, yeah, no, Phil, we should have you on just for part of Aliens. Okay, that's perfect. Okay, Sean, Tony, I guess you'll answer this. So, Aliens superior to the original Alien, then, would you say, for sure?
No.
I don't know if I can go that far. As a rewatchability standpoint, I prefer watching Aliens more than I prefer Alien. However, I can't say that one is better than the other.
Okay.
Different genres.
Different
completely
genres.
Different genres.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. That's a good way to go. That's a good diplomatic way to go. Good job. Okay, last movie. What is it?
All right, we had to do some soul searching. We looked deep within ourselves, and we arrived at what I find to be a dark and beautiful place, the 1992 blockbuster Batman Returns.
You squeezed it in.
Oh my gosh.
We've done so many other Batman movies, but we didn't do Batman Returns. Okay.
Yes, so we will enter the dark and semi-depraved world of Tim Burton, who I love. And you guys have done a few of his. You did Edward Scissorhands, which is near and dear to my heart. So I wanted to go into the Tim Burton universe. And as a young kid, I was 5 when this movie came out, and my parents let me watch it, and upon rewatching it, we'll dive deep into it, but there's some material in there that probably a child of that age shouldn't be exposed to, but my parents are pretty progressive, so we're gonna have fun with this, especially all the Danny DeVito chat.
Okay. Peak Walken, I would say.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Walken, oh, I have so many thoughts on Walken's performance in this. He is outstanding.
Okay, expect
and Michelle
me to,
Pfeiffer.
Yeah, it's Michelle Pfeiffer. So that's my Michelle Pfeiffer movie. Expect me to talk about 10 minutes on the Susie and the Banshees song as well. So, okay.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know who you guys are. I have no idea. I haven't met you. I don't know who you guys look like, but I really appreciate that you're now in my life.
We are fired up to be in your life. This is... I do just want to mention that I have a self-proclaimed PhD in the Predator universe.
Wow.
As well as possibly one in the Alien/Aliens universe. And I've got a few hot takes on Ridley Scott that I'd like to air out.
Okay. Okay. I look forward to those. I want to say... Hey, Roy, were you with me when we went to the Chinese theater and we saw...
Predator vs. Alien?
We saw Predator vs. Alien, yes.
In Hollywood, yeah.
Yes, AVP.
Yeah, okay, that was good. I think my favorite part is when Predator showed some remorse, you know, through bowing his head slightly in that movie. Okay, we'll figure out the technology between now and then, but just, plan on two Thursdays from now. And we'll get this done. We'll get the work done. We'll make it happen. So,
awesome.
Thanks very much.
Look forward to seeing you in person, John. And hopefully, we're not since you don't know what we look like. Hopefully, we don't scare you. It's not quite DeVito Penguin, but you'll get a look at our mugs.
No, I won't actually, because we'll also record on Skype.
Oh, okay. So it's just gonna be. Just blind.
Yeah, yeah. So don't shower that day. I never do on Thursdays.
I won't. I'll bathe in salmon so that I have the fish scent.
Okay, no, perfect. That'll be safe from all these things that are hunting us.
it's true.
Okay, Cortezi Bros. Thanks very much for the call. Hopefully this picks up on audio. We'll see if it does. Fine if it doesn't, but 2 weeks.
If it doesn't, we can retry.
Yeah, we can. It'll work. Don't worry. It'll work. Just get pumped for 2 weeks from now.
Woo!
We will be fired up and ready.
Alrighty, bye. Awesome. Okay, we're going to let you go, and right, I'm going to get pumped for those movies.
Already pumped.
All right.
I will talk then.
All right, later, bros.
All right, my man.
All right. Okay, now, could you guys hear
fun
that
fact,
sort
I once,
of okay?
Yeah, I could hear it reasonably okay.
Yeah, you
fun fact,
hear
I
it.
Once listened to, I once watched Aliens every day for a month. On VHS. I think it was 34 days. I can't remember exactly, but it was at least a month. I watched it every day in its entirety on VHS when I was about 14, I think.
Isn't that an incredible lineup of movies?
That's
so good. Yeah. I definitely thought about Aliens for my own picks last time, and now I'm gutted that I didn't.
Phil, maybe we'll call you, but if nothing else, send us a message. We'll read whatever speed you have on Aliens. Send me your awards too. That'll work too.
Oh yeah, definitely. I don't think I've seen the Batman one, but Predator and Aliens, my God.
How have you not seen Batman Returns, man?
I've never been into Batman, really.
Oh.
It's a good Christmas movie.
Yeah,
I've seen the first Tim Burton one. Jack Nicholson Joker. I think that's the only one I've ever seen.
The only Batman movie you've ever seen? You never saw the Nolan ones?
No.
Oh.
I should. I know I should. I just don't like Batman.
Well, if Batman's not your guy, dislike then Batman, that's fine. But I mean, The Dark Knight, the one with Heath Ledger, like, Batman's not even... Like, he's the fifth billed person in that movie. Like, everyone else in the movie is more important. I think you'd really like The Dark Knight, but...
Yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, that's in 2 weeks. The Cortese brothers, they've got a... It's going to be a bro fest. so, okay.
They sound very enthusiastic, bless them. I look forward to it.
Yeah, okay, we got that going for us. So, next future business, we're going to get Zoe on the phone from last night when we...
Not yet.
Are we not doing
that?
Okay.
Not yet. No, we
What's
will,
next...
but first
we
got to talk about...
categories?
Community service.
Okay, what about the community service?
Cortese, the Cortese twins. Twins. They're not twins. The Cortese brothers are going to be forced to watch three movies about twins.
Twins did win.
Twins won by one vote.
So they're honorary
No Nacho Libre, which breaks my heart, but we're going to be watching some Twins movies.
I'll watch Nacho Libre later. I'll get that out of the system later. But twin movies, that's good. I mean, okay, we got the whole Haley Mills, you know, Parent Trap twin movie situation.
And can I just say, Return of the Jedi? I don't think I'm going to get a pick, but I'm going to be campaigning super hard for Return of the Jedi.
Okay, yeah. We could do Return of the Jedi. That's definitely a twin movie. We have the Lindsay Lohan Parent Trap, right? We have the Bette Midler, Lily Tomlin twins, two sets of twins switched at birth movie. I want to say Big Business or something like that. Something like that.
I don't know.
We've got the Jeremy Irons as evil twin gynecologist in Dead Ringers.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's going to win.
You know, but we also have Margot Kidder in the movie Sisters, which is like a super creepy twins movie.
Hmm. Okay. We have The Craze about the... I want to say... Phil, The Craze. They're famous gangsters over there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, famous gangsters over in the UK. I don't know the details, but I do know in the movie The Craze, they're played by the two brothers from the band Spandau Ballet.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I saw them in concert.
Wow, really?
Like
The Craze?
2-3 years ago, yeah. Mr. Spandau himself. Okay, so also, we should not neglect to mention there's a movie called Twins. With Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, sure. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, well, okay, that's right up there. Okay, sorry. Now we talk to Zoe about our future Halloween business. Something that... I'm just going to say right now, just in case the editing goes weird, we recorded our conversation last night, right?
Yep.
And so this is us talking to Zoe about potential categories, like... We have six potential categories. We're going to narrow that down for three categories for Halloween. And from those three categories, it's going to be nine Halloween movies that we're going to do for the month of October, which is a spectacular thing that we do every year. Okay.
I love it.
Yeah. So here's that conversation and go. Okay. We are on the phone. And Zoe, that we haven't talked to Zoe since October, but it's time to do... October scary movie Halloween-y categories. It's time.
Yes.
We're doing it. And okay, we're gonna each pick two categories, right? Is that what we're doing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's the case. And we've this is kind of like draft style, right? So the order's been chosen. I believe it's me, and then is it John, then Zoe?
Okay.
Oh, snake draft, baby! I get two in a row.
And then, yeah, and then I'm all for doing the boomerang.
Okay. Love and also an important thing that we have to anticipate is how much contention we have for each other's categories. Like saying that's not a category, or we did that, but that's not scary enough. So I'm prepped. I'm prepped to both
I'm
love
too.
And hate your picks. Okay.
Yes, agreed.
Okay. Also, Roy. The way this is going to work is we're going to like have a poll, right? And it's going to have all six categories. And I think each of us, with our two categories, you probably need to vote for only one of yours, and then you can throw your other votes wherever you want, just to ensure that, like, if one of you guys picks two really lame categories that no one else votes for, then you're still going to get one of your categories, right? That is how that's going to work.
So, are we going to do it that way, or are we going to have three separate polls where it's like? Okay, which of these two categories wins?
No.
We're not doing that?
No, we'll throw all six on a poll, and whichever of each of our two categories gets the most votes is the one that gets picked from yours, and then, you know, whoever gets the most votes total, moving on down, we'll determine what order we watch
them. I mean, the Facebookers are going to be kind of annoyed, right, when... the second most popular thing does not get to be a category.
That's possible. And so I don't care.
So everybody get prepared to be disappointed.
So we'll spell it out in the poll as quickly and concisely as I can.
Yeah.
That, hey, you know, vote for whatever you want, but just know that at least one category from each of us is moving forward. So I'll start. You guys ready?
I think yes. I'm ready. I'm just going to... putting on my anger gloves and go.
Okay, my number one pick is Dario Argento horror films.
Okay. Oh, I love you so much. We haven't done, I don't think we've done any Dario Argento, have we?
I love you so much.
No, we haven't, yeah.
That's kind of weird. I'm kind of surprised. Okay. Kind of obvious. Okay. Well, everybody get ready to watch Deep Red. Okay, that's fine. All right. My number one category is, hey, you know what? We've had a lot of fun with found footage, and we've had a lot of fun with mockumentaries, but hey, here's something novel. How about documentaries? Just straight up documentaries.
Oh.
So we're talking like it could be a documentary about a horror film if we want to be boring, but that's totally fine. Or it could be a documentary on a freaky subject, like that nightmare movie about the sleep paralysis where there's a demon in your bed and it's a documentary. It could just be a documentary about some Halloween related thing. Or a movie that's never been released, I think, like that American movie about that weird guy who made the Halloween movie, but the documentary on the movie is really good. So, documentaries. Novel idea, huh?
I love it. Dude, I love it.
Very
I love
good.
It. I love it. So, my first category is underseen creature features.
Okay. So, how do we define underseen?
I've got a whole list. I've done like maybe an hour and a half worth of research on underseen creature features.
Okay. So it's movies on your list.
So like Zoe's list creature features, or we can call it like lesser known creature features.
Sure.
Okay.
I don't know. Underseen. No. Maybe I'm too specific there, but
so we're talking like outside of like the big ones, right? Like so we're not talking like Wolfman and Frankenstein. We're talking some lesser known creature features.
Yeah. The genesis of this category was a movie that I bought, a Criterion movie I've got, but I also have it digitally. It's called Equinox from 1970-something. And so that was kind of the genesis because I've never seen it, and I'd never heard it until we did a blind buy on Criterion. So that's the genesis of this.
Okay, ooh. One more question. So it's like the movie is lesser known. Also, the creature is lesser known. So even though, like Dario Argento's Dracula might be out because no one watched it. I guess we could watch it in the Dario Argento one, but Dracula is too popular of a creature. Like, also the creatures are unpopular.
Huh.
Yeah, so it's the lesser known.
Just movies that hadn't, like, just creature movies that no one, like that a lot of people have not seen, like a lot of blind spots for people. The movie itself, so, but lesser known creature, I hadn't thought of that.
Well, it's your category. So if you still want it, if you wanted to, like, so we could throw in a Frankenstein movie as long as it's like the Polish Frankenstein movie that no one's ever seen.
Well,
right?
on your list, are there any Frankenstein movies?
You son of a... Yes, there's actually a Hammer movie that's Frankenstein. It's kind of in the back, but that's lower down. But I've got three specific movies that I'm like, these, a lot of people have not seen these. So, anyway.
Okay. Sounds good to me.
I'm not picking a Frankenstein movie, so I'll just use my agency to do that. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, Zoe, you get to go again.
Okay. This one I was actually pretty excited for. I kind of hope the creature feature wins, but I am doing 80s Slashers Part 2.
So is it the slashers after the ones we just watched last year or 2 years ago?
So this is not only a part 2 of what I did last year, but it's also part 2s of slashers.
So it's specifically part 2s. Okay, so you really want to watch Halloween 2. That's what you're telling me.
I mean, 1981, that would check off some criteria for me on a movie watch I'm doing, but no, Halloween 2 is not what I want to watch.
Oh, really?
Razorbacks 2?
Razorback 2.
I don't know. Return of the Swamp Thing, does that count? I don't know.
No.
Does part 2 have to be in the title? Or is it just, can it be any
second? As long as it's a sequel, it doesn't, part 2 does not have to be in the title.
Okay. Cool. All right. I'm for that. John?
Okay.
What's your second pick?
Next one is 19th century period pieces. The story has to take place in the 1800s.
Ooh.
So possibly, lots of Dracula and Frankenstein potential, but a Lizzie Borden movie wouldn't be bad either.
Crimson Peak. Just kidding, that movie's terrible.
it has its moments. There is a list. I haven't seen it.
That's a Jessica Chastain's one of the angriest redheads I know. Okay. All right, so you know, I had three chosen in case we doubled up, but you guys never disappoint in coming up with completely original stuff. So I'm gonna go. I really hope my first pick gets picked. I don't think it will, but my second choice is going to be horror comedies.
Yeah, that's gonna win.
Yeah, I think so. But anyway, we'll see.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we have to have the light one.
Sounds good. Oh, I'm so excited. I'm already starting to think of movies for all three of these. So all six of these, I guess, huh?
Right, but three of them will be slashed. So I guess we can save them for next year if they don't make it. So that'll be fine. That'll be fun. It'll be good.
Yay!
Man, I can't believe it's already here. Man.
Holy cow, can you believe it?
I'm so excited and stressed out. Yeah.
So today's September 2nd. yesterday I was ready to start watching some horror movies, but I think I'm gonna, so I don't burn out by October 3rd, I think I'm gonna wait until mid-September to start, but I am kind of itching to go.
Right, okay, well get your cues all situated.
Yeah.
Alright, well, okay, listeners, you heard all that. We're recording this now. If it's not too obvious, we're recording this before we actually record the podcast proper that you're listening to right now. But
John, you gave up our secrets.
That's all there. I just want to make sure it's not confusing, although, because I'm really confused already. Every time we do this out of order, I'm just like, what, you know, how does time travel work? It's working, apparently. So, okay. Listeners, you got the information. Use the information. The important thing is just check the Facebook page and just do your duty and vote. Even though you didn't vote in the national election, vote in this one. So go ahead and do that.
All right. Perfect. Gents, I can't wait to start doing business with you.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, I've missed you two so much. You don't even know.
Okay, so that conversation's over. Phil, you didn't hear it, but I didn't write them down. JR, did you write down the
categories? Yeah, I've got it. Okay, so to recap what you just heard on the air, yes. Phil, we are either... So each of us picked two categories, and each of us is going to get one of our two. So I chose Dario Argento horror films, which is the Italian horror films like Suspiria, right? And horror comedies. John, do you remember your two?
I think I chose just scary documentaries, or documentaries about a scary subject, or Halloween, or whatever. And also I picked movies, like scary movies that take place in the 1800s.
Yeah, and there's a lot of them, so there's a lot of great choices there. Zoe chose lesser known creature features, which I think he just has a list and that's kind of in his head, but and then he put 80s slashers part 2, which means 80s slashers sequels, but not like the third or fourth of the series. It has to be the second movie. So I'm counting Psycho 2, by the way.
Ooh.
Where the Psycho 2 comes out in 1982 or something.
That'll be good. Okay.
Yeah,
that'll be super good. Okay, so anyway, so we got, okay, so let me get this straight. We got, so the next ones we're watching are Aliens, Predator, and Batman Returns. That's for next time. And then after that, we're watching three movies about twins or triplets. We said triplets are okay too.
Sure.
Which, you know.
But not quads. Quads are right out.
Right out. Yes. Okay, and then after that, we're doing, okay, all sorts of horror movies. So if you're tired listening, just imagine how tired we are, but yet we're having more fun than you are listening. So it evens out, I guess. So, okay, yeah. That's future business. That was a long future business. That's going to be...
It was.
That's rough.
There's going to be a lot of voting to be done in the very near future, so look forward to that.
Yeah.
You guys, if this is the first time you've listened to this podcast... Please check out our blog where you can download every single one of them. And John has wonderful kind of liner notes for each episode. That is yours, mine, theirs, podcast.blogspot.com. Let's see, what else? You got to go onto iTunes and give us a 5-star review, and then you can say whatever you want. We don't care, but we need the 5-star review.
I think it's called Apple Music these days, but you know, whatever. iTunes at all.
Yeah. Also, we have an email address, so email us. We would check it more often if you would send us emails more often, okay?
Right.
So it's yoursmindtheirs at gmail.com. Yoursmindtheirspodcast.
Make us check the box, yes.
Make us check the box. And then, John, if someone wants to call us either angrily or happily, What's the phone number?
We'll take either emotion. The number is 801-896-4542, and that number is 801-896-4542. We might have to have the Cortese brothers leave a like 2-hour voicemail on that.
Yeah.
And then we'll just plug our voices in to the voicemail. That might be how we record next week, but we'll see how it goes.
Well, good times. So, Phil, I want to say thank you so much. This is you're back again. We enjoyed you last year. This is such a pleasure doing this with you, and I know it's thank crazy you. Late there, so your Friday is going to be kind of crappy. Yes. But we need to make a tradition of having you on, so we need to bring you back again at some point. So it's always really fun.
Yeah, always an absolute treat to speak to you guys. Thank you. It's a real pleasure, and I'm very, very pleased to have been asked on. And, yeah, same time next year maybe.
Seems to be our
thing. September, August kind of time.
Okay, yeah. Pen that in. Pen in same time next year. Pencil in, you know, sometime in the spring.
Cool.
All right. Okay. Thanks as always to Phil. And let me just, I'll just echo what JR said. It's always a pleasure. Roy, it's a pleasure with you too. Not as much, but still it's a positive experience. That's all I have to say. I'm saying goodbye, you guys. Do you have anything else?
Nope. Good night, everybody.
Bye. Okay, I think it was 1994, and it was unrelated to the movie Backbeat, but it was kind of around the same time. There was a scandalous book written about John Lennon by a guy named Albert Goldman. And,
really?
It was apparently it was a really big to do, and I kind of remember this happening. But a lot of people claimed that he just made up a bunch of stuff, and you know the fact checking was kind of spurious, and yada yada yada. And so it was this big thing where this guy wrote this sordid tale of John Lennon, and his name was Albert Goldman. Anyway, in the Saturday Night Live sketch, they said, why did you do this? Why did you want to take down John Lennon? You know, and he's like, well, after what they did to me. And then there's a flashback of how Albert Goldman, the author of this book, was the fifth member of the Beatles, and he was the Beatles' tromboner.
He was their tromboner.
Yeah.
Rod Serling.
Yes, Rod Serling. Holy cow, deep cut.
Deep cut.
So anyway, it was how the Beatles had to kick him out because he was lame at the shows, and also he was a big jerk. Yeah. So that's what the sketch was.
That's really interesting. So I've just Googled Albert Goldman, and 1994, if that's when it came out, that's wild, because that's when I was most into the Beatles, and I'd read just about every biography of the Beatles going, but I've never heard that.
Really?
But looking at the synopsis of his book, I was 88 it came out, so maybe it was got famous a bit later.
Oh, okay, no, I just...
Oh, he died in 94. Maybe that's why it achieved some attention. Goldman died in 1994.
I don't know where I came up with 1994, but it makes sense that it's 88, because the cast makes sense.
It's Phil Hartman.
Yeah, looking at the synopsis,
it touches on the
sexuality of John Lennon, which is something we may come on to.
We may! Hey, by the way, just a sound check, I'm assuming you can hear the air conditioner in the background. I don't know what to do.
Also, fun fact, in the early 70s, John said, if John Lennon, Ringo Starr, and George Harrison were to reform and play some songs, it would be with Klaus Voormann on bass.
for real?
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, Klaus. Klaus is the glue that holds all these stories together.
Klaus later was Dieter's monkey on Sprockets. What is that?
Not me.
What? The air conditioner? Yeah. I got kicked out of the house again. Sorry!
Oh my gosh. That was like a massive truck going past.
I don't know what to do!